Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Yeah, it's typical around here. Typical what goes on before the show. I got one hand on my big, stainless steel water cup. I got my other hand on a mouse checking my last email. Just got a notice from Brianna. So she'll be joining us here in just a bit. This is fascinating. Yesterday, if you missed it, I had a very spicy discussion with Warren, who does Wake Up New Orleans. So he is to the left of leftists. I like Warren. I really do. But we don't agree on anything. And so it was a really fun show. If you get a chance to listen to it yesterday, Warren and I had way too much fun. But there's a lot of things that's interesting when you're debating leftists. And Brianna's on now, so I'll tell her this real quickly, that they'll start to say things. You can tell when they're losing or they're flustered, because they'll say, that's just your opinion, or those are just talking points, or you don't know what you're talking about, or, let me explain this to you. I just start laughing, right? So Brianna, if you get a chance to listen to yesterday's show with Warren, it's like my little tutorial on how to debate leftists. But it's interesting. He made some interesting points. There's some things we agree on, especially if you listen to the first hour. And Warren came on in the third hour. It was really quite a report. But anyway, Brianna's here. Let's get her theme. Let's get going with government inquiry and see to where we are going to inquire. Oh. Wrong place. It's under G. I gotta structure my things better. Some, I think they're under names for some and reports for others. So there we go. Let me see. Ah, there it is. Okay. Be right back. She started as a guest on Action Radio, courtesy of our Constitution reporter, Amber Kemper. Both Brianna and Amber are graduates of Patriot Academy, a place where young folks get to practice writing and advocating legislation and being legislators in a mock session. Brianna immediately impressed all of us as someone we wanted on the show with her own report. With an insightful mind, asking and taking on complex questions, and a growing skill in sarcasm and satire, plus her study of government, history, the Constitution, and our founding, all of her skills and knowledge combine into something pretty incredible here on Action Radio. And now, the Government Inquiry Report with Brianna Cannon. Once again, making you sound really good. I really like that intro. Good morning, Brianna. What's going on? What's happening?
Thank you. Well, today I'm probably going to just use the same notes I had from last week.
Well, that sounds good. That's very common. I think of Action Radio as like a fluid thing. You look at most newscasts and it's like once the half hour of the segment or the 2 minutes you get is over, that's it. They never talk about it again. Things here are completely fluid. You can bring up any topic from any week, especially if we haven't covered it, because I'd rather have the sequence of, and get the full story down. I mean, if we can do it in one show, great. It takes two shows. Many times I have to do part shows. I'll do like one, two, sometimes three parts to a show if there's enough information on it. I think the most they did was four in the Supreme Court. But that was a WBY thing. But you never know. Anyway, so let's start last week. Recap for us. Where were we, and where are we going?
Okay. I actually don't think we hit any of these except for one.
that sounds like us.
So,
digressing is like a lifestyle. I have a feeling.
Yeah. So. The first thing, and you actually also mentioned this last week, and it's something that's really talked about. It's about the Teamsters strike, and supposedly that whenever they were striking, they wanted four extra sick days. Is why they were striking.
You're talking about the railroad
and
workers,
instead
I
of
think.
Like,
I think you mean the railroad workers other than the Teamsters.
Yes.
Unless there's a team, then that could be a Teamster Railroad Worker Union. I don't know. The Teamsters actually have airline pilots. I was a Teamster for several years on a job I was on, so I'm pretty familiar with the Teamsters. And so, you might ask, what was a conservative doing working for the Teamsters? I believe in private unions, and we can talk about that too. But tell me about what you've got on the strike and the sick days.
Yeah, it was the railroad one.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was for four sick days, but instead of giving them four more sick days, the government paid $36 billion to them from their, like, $3 trillion COVID fund or whatever.
Wow.
And they were kind of, like, threatening their jobs with it.
I'm trying to think. So the government, what did the government, let's go into this a little bit because I'm a little confused. What did the government exactly pay for? Where did they send the money to the railroad workers union? Was it a benefit fund, a workman's comp thing? Or what? Where exactly did that $36 billion go?
I don't actually know. I mean, I know it was, you know, to, well, what they claimed was to keep it running and stuff.
Uh-huh.
It's like critical if they like will shut down or anything.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just curious. And like I say, like every question, sometimes they require research. In fact, you talk to Derek Park, my financial reporter. I drive him crazy because I always ask him things. Greg, I don't know that. Let me go look it up for next week. Okay, fine. So this goes on all the time. I got a question for you. But now the railroad workers, that's a government union, I'm pretty sure, right? Because these are – especially the Amtrak portion of it, and I don't know how much of the freight lines – I think the freight lines are still private. But do you have a breakdown of how much of the strike was – or did the railroad workers union represent both – do they have like a government side and a private side? How much did you get into it? But
not that much.
See, I told you, impossible questions. Okay. Well, which begs the bigger question, can one union represent both government – and private sector workers? I think they can. I think that the Teamsters has like a government sector union. Okay. So tell me what you found, though. Let's go with that first.
Yeah, that was kind of like what I was wanting to know with this. Basically, like, understand it a little bit more. Because, I mean, is it really like, instead of just giving them $4 to $6, they really just decided to give them billions of dollars?
Well, that's where it went. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, was it a payoff to union leadership?
We're missing something here.
Well, I think we are. Let's use our deductive reasoning powers and let's figure it out. So the workers want sick days. Now, sick days make sense because if you work when you're sick and you're driving a train, you can cause a catastrophic accident causing billions of dollars and potentially costing lives. So it makes sense to not work if you're sick. It makes no sense to force workers to work when they're sick. On the other hand, if they have 3 weeks of sick days, then that's like a vacation. That's like a paid vacation on top of their paid vacation. I don't care if they have five weeks of sick of vacation. I don't care what it is, but it's an interesting thought, you know. So, but 4 days does not seem like a lot of sick days to me.
It really doesn't.
What do you think? Yeah. Well, was anybody in your reading of this, was anybody asking the question that the news was reporting, that the workers are saying, wait, they make us work whether we're sick or not? I mean, that to me is dangerous. That's criminally negligent. That kind of stuff should not go on. Even if they don't get paid for the sick day, they have to be able to take sick days off. What do you think?
I agree. Yeah. I'm looking up like any more information on this part right now.
Yep.
I'm using
like
key words.
No, it's okay. Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of that too. It's weird. I talk about having my right hand on the computer mouse, my left hand on the keyboard, and I'm talking at the same time. It's really weird. This is a great place for multitasking. So feel free. Let's see. But the train strike was averted, but I think these are mostly government. The private would be freight lines. Anyway, the government. Here's a question for you too. Do you think the government should have intervened the branded insurrection, despite the fact that an illegal government? We talked about that. But do you think the federal government has a place intervening in strikes?
I think
or in labor negotiations.
It really depends on who's having the strike. If it's like an actual like government is entity, the right word for this.
That sounds good. No, I mean, yeah, that's the perfectly good word. Yeah, because it covers everything. Yeah. Uh-huh.
With any kind of like strike, it's that the people are like the workers or whatever are wanting something that they're not getting, and so they strike in order to get it, or I guess haggle or whatever with the people who are like in charge of those things. It's kind of hard to say boss. Sometimes people's bosses aren't it. So, I guess it's the people in charge of those areas. And so in the government, if there was a job like that, the government would probably need to intervene.
So one thing you might want to take a look at, and this would be a fascinating study, go back and listen to our Labor Day show, because we went over a lot of labor history. It's something I've been interested in, starting with the Pullman strikes, the coal mining strikes, the Pinkertons, who were World War I soldiers who were unemployed, who ended up actually shooting people who went on strike. I mean, our labor history is fascinating. And I've always been pro-private union, because I know what management's done to people. It's treated them horribly. Have you ever heard of a company town, for example? Do you know what that is?
A company town?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Okay. So this, to me, this is actually worse than slavery, because a slave is not in debt. But in a company town, you're expendable, because there's always somebody else that can work for you. You're always going to debt. So whereas a freed slave would not have a debt to carry to the slave owner, they wouldn't have to pay the slave owner for being freed. Whereas if you're in a company town, you're continually going into debt, because they don't pay you in money. They pay you in what they call scrip. And so this was like coupons that you could redeem at the company store. And what happened was that you would pay the company rent for your cabin. These are like usually mines, obscure places out in the distance. You would pay the company for your rent, and you pay the company for food. Now, the company rigged it so that you never made enough money to cover your expenses. Well, then they'd give you credit, so you go into debt. So the longer you worked in a company town, the greater your debt. You never could escape it. So the only way to escape it was to escape with the debt, which you still had to pay back because you owed the company for working there. And that is one of the origins of the company of the labor unions, because they say, you can't do this. This is criminal. You can't rig the game so that you're making money off workers for impoverishing them. And, of course, a lot of them died because they didn't care. There's no workman's comp. There's no health safety standards. There's no OSHA. There's no regulations. There's no union to protect the workers. They're on their own. And the Supreme Court enforced that with this liberty of contract thing. It's a fascinating thing to take a look at.
Sounds like it. I've never heard of that before, but it is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not
write
surprised
that
I haven't heard of it, though.
Don't worry. Listen, you've got a long time to learn things. don't think. I mean, I've been at this longer than you have, so don't think for a second that because you don't know something. But that's not why I tell you. I tell you these things to inspire you to, when you get a chance to take a look at them. You know, that's
Yeah.
Is that your phone? Is that your phone ringing?
No, it's my dad.
Oh, okay. Tell your dad to take his phone away.
For it. Yeah.
Okay.
For
well, let's
I know
fast
it
forward
has
to...
something.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. With the money, where it went, it was some sort of like a pension thing for them that would like, I think had to do with like, buddy, stop it. Sorry.
That's okay. It's funny. The thing. Listen, stuff happens all the time. I have garbage trucks go by. They interrupt the show. And, my friend Alan Dawson used to have tropical birds because he called us from Belize. So we just run with it.
Yeah. That it was going to be paying, like, in the future, where I think it was, like, their Social Security back or something like that. For their pension plan. I'm looking this up right now.
Yeah, let me bring Priyanka in the conversation here. But this is really interesting because, you know, like I say, I've been pro-union. To me, it's freedom of assembly, that you have a situation where workers get represented by a union to counterbalance management, which bargains collectively. So in other words, they bargain as a unit. You don't go to one manager and negotiate a deal, and if that's not good enough, you go to another manager and get a different deal. It usually doesn't work that way. So the worker is the individual versus the company represented by management. So the whole purpose of unions is that the worker gets representation equal to management, and the union bargains with management instead of the worker. When that doesn't work, they end up doing things like calling a strike. Piaki, you want to make a comment here? Let's get you in the conversation.
Yeah, good morning. Federal government has no business getting involved with private unions. That's ridiculous. Private
yeah, but I think
unions
it might be a government union. Some of this might be.
Well,
do you know how much of this is government?
Union?
Well, no, Amtrak is.
Maybe, yes.
Well, Amtrak was involved in the strike. That's what I'm asking is where's the split between government and private? I think the freight lines are private.
Then he can apply to Amtrak. If we was, if my construction company was putting a bridge up like we've done many, and the union, iron workers, went on strike, so what did the government do? Come in and tell them that we're going to give you sick days off? You got to have a bridge to get across the water, right?
I know that the Teamsters is a private one, not a government one, but I don't know how many different ones are associated with the railroads.
The reason why come Amtrak is in existence because people wouldn't travel that way no more.
So
they created Amtrak in order to keep passenger trains in existence. If not, they would have went out of existence. They was not profitable.
Well, this is a great question. I want to get to that bit because I'm going to talk about airline deregulation too. But airlines, and see, I've seen the whole country by train, and that was. And so look at this. But let me get back to Brianna on the whole idea of unionizing, of the government union versus the private union versus government interference in negotiations. Bianchi's against it. Where are you?
What government should do is provide the National Labor Relationship Board provides arbitrators when you have an impasse between the union and the industry. And there's an impasse, and they provide arbitrators to keep both sides at the table talking. Iron workers went on 16-week strike in St. Louis back in the 70s. I think it was 72, I believe it was. 16 weeks. You know, government come in and say, well, we're going to give you this, that, and that, because they couldn't. It was none of their business.
Yeah. Okay, hold on a second. I want to get Brianna into this, and then I got a couple of questions for her as well. Brianna?
Yeah, so is the question like whether I'm for the
Well, Pianchi's made a case, and I tend to agree with it, that the unions, that the government should not be involved in the labor negotiations. And I'm saying it gets confusing because you've got a government union and you've got private unions with the freight companies. So it's freight plus passenger. So I'm just curious where you, from what you found, you know, where you stand on that. And then I got a question on just strikes in general, because this is a big topic.
Yeah. As of now, like with the knowledge that I have, I would say that if it's like a government union, which, you know, probably really risky being corrupted, but if it is like a government union, then that's something that the like, governments themselves would have to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's not, I mean, it's like private unions, then I don't believe the government should interact with that.
Okay. Do you know how strikes work? Do you know why unions go on strike?
I know it's whenever like a certain demand isn't met that the workers are really wanting.
Mm-hmm. So what makes a strike effective then?
There's nobody to run the business or work the jobs.
Wow. But why doesn't the company just hire more people? You know, just hire different people. Just fire everybody and hire a whole bunch of new people. Then you wouldn't have a strike.
Well,
hold on, Pianchi. Hold on. I want to get an answer on this. I'm asking this for a specific reason. Brianna, let's get your brain thinking about this.
I mean, normally I think because it's like a really lengthy like process, you know. Kind of rebuild like your entire staff of whatever job it is, but I think there's something else to it.
There is. Yeah, there's a loaded rhetorical question. Bianchi, go ahead.
Well, when unions go on strike, they put up picket lines.
Mm-hmm.
And when they put up a picket line, other trades, other unions, whether it was delivery, supplies would not cross that picket line. Therefore, the operations of the company would come to a standstill. Also, the union members would not be making money either. Now, some unions do have what's called strike funds, where they provide some sort of payment to their union members while they're on strike, and especially those that's walking picket at different operations. So they do get paid, but they're not getting paid their full pay.
Yeah, so there's a cost to both sides for a strike because the company is losing money because they're not the goods aren't being produced or services, and the workers are losing money because they're not working. So a strike is a serious venture. It's not something to be done lightly. But as I understand the laws, at least in the private companies, they can't hire people. The unions call them scabs. Those are people that take the jobs of other people who are on strike. Now, I'm not sure exactly how it works. I'd have to do a little research myself. But a strike is only effective if the company cannot hire other people to replace them. So that you're making
the
company...
They could hire other people, but other people don't cross the strike line. And
okay,
if we had a project and it needed to have a delivery of concrete, where the concrete drivers for the concrete company would not produce a batch of concrete to send out to that job.
Yeah,
that's the way
yeah.
they honor picket lines.
Yeah.
And when
I don't
was
wanna...
a kid, my grandfather taught me not to cross a picket line.
Right. I want to direct this back to government inquiry if we can. I mean, because I love talking labor stuff, but we only have Brianna for a certain amount of time each week, and I want to get back to the whole idea of the government interfering in this. So a strike, in order to be effective, the company cannot replace the workers while they're on strike, but it's still a serious venture. Now let's talk about government unions and the policy of the whole idea of the Brandon insurrection interfering in this. Can government workers go on strike? Brianna.
Well, I mean, offhand, I would say like everybody could go on strike if they wanted to.
Technically.
But,
go ahead.
Honestly, I haven't ever thought about this. So, of course, that's why you'd ask it, right?
Of course. You know that by now.
I would still think so, yeah.
Okay. It's actually against the law. In fact, strikes have been broken. There was a steel strike that Truman, and they fired everybody. Do you remember Ronald Reagan and the air traffic control? I think it was called PATCO, the something of air traffic controllers back in the 80s. They all went on strike. Do you know what happened to them?
No.
They all got fired. Now, I thought it was endangering our air traffic control system. See, the reason, so the logic is the government employees provide a vital national service, and they're trading, you know, a company which can hire and fire and replace and do all kinds of other things for the security of a government job. But the implication is that you have to keep doing your job. You cannot go on strike. You know, the military can't go on strike. The certain things that just the transit workers, the various things cannot go on strike. Now, certain governments let them, local, city, state, and national government do let government workers go on strike, but they don't have to, and they shouldn't, because that's the trade-off. So do you see the distinction there between a government worker and a government union and a private worker and a private union? What do you think?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you agree or disagree with government workers being able to go on strike?
I guess because of, like, the contract that they enter into and because of, like, the job, I think it would make sense to not be able to go on strike in those situations. But,
okay.
I mean,
now,
I guess
what
now
if
it
they're,
is illegal to
what if they're
have a railroad strike, too, though.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, say that again.
And that gets a little bit tricky, though, because that would be, like, a private union, not necessarily government union. So that's when an illegal strike kind of gets trickier, I guess, in the balance of that, because I don't know. Would the government have that ability
to do what?
I mean, they did it, but say it's illegal to have a railroad strike.
Bianchi?
Well, federal employees cannot strike, but some states allow their state employees to strike.
Let me ask you a bigger question, Brianna. Should federal workers or any government workers be able to unionize?
I would think so, but I'm not completely sure, but I would think so.
Okay. I mean, and you can think about it and come back next week. How about teachers? Should teachers be able to unionize, or should they be able to go on strike?
I think so, yeah.
Interesting. Because as recently as FDR, government workers were not allowed to unionize. It's only since John Kennedy who signed an executive order that federal workers were allowed to unionize. There's no law. Congress never passed a law on this. They've just done it by executive order, which leads to the question, when Trump comes back in 2024, do you think he should revoke that executive order and not allow union federal workers to unionize anymore?
But,
hold on. I want to get an answer.
It was so to not allow federal employees to unionize anymore.
Mm-hmm. In other words, an executive order by one president can be countered by another president. So I'm surprised Trump didn't do this. But when Trump comes back in 2024, which I sincerely hope, do you think that that's an executive order that he should repeal?
Honestly, I don't know enough about it to really say which way is better.
Okay. We'll revisit this next week. Bianca, let's get a comment, and then I want to get to the other things Brianna has on her list.
Well, yes, there's national federations that represent federal employees.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are labor union representatives. A small number, the numbers of federal employees, numbers of labor unions other in commercial construction is drastically reduced from what it was. But yes, there are national organizations that represent federal employees. You have federal employee credit unions, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. I think those should be open to everybody. Do you think that the federal unions, this is a question from Bianca, then I'll get back to Brianna. Bianca, do you think the federal unions should exist but not allow them to strike, that the government would maintain that rule?
The law already says that they can't strike at the federal level.
Right.
Now, state public workers can strike, but federal workers can't strike because of the necessity of their jobs for the public.
Yeah. See, the way I see it, Brianna, is that the government unions are different than private unions. A private union and a company is a closed system. The company only makes so much money. The workers can only demand so much money. If the workers and the union demand too much, the company goes broke. If the company is so harsh with the workers, nobody wants to work for them. And so there's a kind of trade-off. They have to work together. But there's only so much money available. There's only so much profit. There's only so much, you know, based on what the good or service that the company is selling. Whereas the government has an unlimited resource of money that's not theirs. It's our money. It's tax dollars. So I would revoke any government union. I would make it illegal for any government to unionize, because the people they're negotiating with, the legislators, are not using their own money. It's not a closed system. There's an infinite amount of tax money that can be drawn from us that the politicians can give to the unions in exchange for votes. So it's a completely corrupt system. It actually goes into vote fraud, as far as I'm concerned, that the government uses the unions. Hold on a second. I want to finish this. The government uses the unions, and the unions use the government. The government funds the unions. It funds the workers through these contracts, and the workers pay dues to the union, and the union contributes to the politicians. So that's an entire system. Let me get Brianna's comment on that, and then I'll get back to you, Bianchi. Based on what I've just told you, does that change your view at all?
Absolutely. And I think I knew that there's something like that you're going to know, or that was going to come up.
You're getting to know me pretty well now. Yeah, exactly. Okay, because you're a smart kid, so you know, it's good to know. Okay, so let me get a comment, and then I'll get Bianchi's comment, and then I want to go to the next thing that we talked about. So did you finish your thought on that? That it does change your mind?
Yeah, so definitely. I think we all know that it's been proven that our government is not very frugal with its money, and giving them more control over it. It's not
well, the frugal
idea.
With their mind, there's not frugal with ours. Okay, Bianca, let's get your comment, and then we'll get back to Brianna. Bianca?
Well, you know, this country has always had, well, I don't want to say all, but they had what they called the American Federation of Labor, the Congress of Industrial Organization, and most labor unions belong to the AFL-CIO. But there also was competing unions, and I think they was called the CIU. Congress of Industrial Unions or something like that. So companies had competing unions in which they could engage in contract with. I think they got that up in Chicago. But the AFL-CIO is not the only one. There's another entity out there that has workers too that's available, that can be used, they may not have the same benefits, they may not have the same wage scale, but they are another union.
Yeah, the AFL joined with the CIO. There's also the IWW, which is the Communist Front. Those are the International Workers of the World. And there's union history is fascinating. I mean, Brandon, we should visit this again because the labor history is incredible. And it's not reported. And it's not taught in schools. No surprise there. So what else do we have from last week? This report goes so fast. I can't believe it. What else you got? What's on your mind?
You're talking to me now?
Yes, I am. You're the one with the notes from last week. Bianca and I, we don't take notes from last week. I got notes. I got like eight books, spiral notebooks that I have, 5 7-inch notebooks that I filled up already just in the last 4 years I've been doing the show. Our anniversary is Saturday, by the way, 4 years on the air at Blog Talk. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah. I'm going to real quickly share what I found on this, and then I'll move on to the next topic.
Okay. We'll take
your time. So it was... Basically, the fund was to be able to be stable until 2051. Was a labor agreement. He said that they negotiated the labor agreement with railroad companies to not include paid sick leave. And then, where was it? I had just found it in this article, and now I can't find it anymore. But it was basically their futures are all kind of like settled with their payments.
See, this doesn't make sense to me to go with, the workers need the money now and they need the sick leave so that they can actually take sick days off and not endanger everybody where that train goes. The idea that they're forcing people to work for them when they're sick is criminal. You know, and then it's going to result in a major tragedy one day. And this is so foreseeable. I can see it happening, as clear as anything else. So this makes no sense. But the government is basically trading future payoffs in a future administration and a future budget. So in other words, it's the old kick the can down the road. We'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. So they're not dealing with the situation today, which is wages, benefits, and sick leave. They're doing future pensions. And they're just assuming the government's going to have the money to fund it.
Yeah, and I'm actually not positive.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm actually not positive on whether it's sick leave in general, like just getting like the extra days of sick leave, or specifically like getting extra days of paid sick leave. And I don't know if it's like specifically they want them to be paid or if they just want the sick days in general. So I'm not really sure on like the specifics on that part.
Okay. Pianca, one quick comment and then I want to get to the next topic.
Let me say something. Sick leave is bogus. Really, how the heck you catch a cold? Well, let me tell you what is abused. DC police, and I can't think of the name that they're called. If a person gets hurt, Capitol Police, and I don't know if it's still this way. If you get hurt, well, you have to be off. You can be off for 40 years. All you got to do is have your doctor write up and say, I don't think he should go to work. You could be can be off your entire career, say 40 years, by just getting that one note from your doctor, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, that's a whole corrupt situation. Yeah, that's worth investigating. But I want to, let me get back to Brianna here, and that just makes me mad. That's the blood pressure story of the day, Brianna. What else did we get from last week?
So there was this one, agreement of some sort that Biden had made with the ATF, everybody's favorite organization. And it was about any kind of like paper mistakes, like on the paperwork. I guess that they're adding that to like, but they're calling lying in, like, sales or whatever. So any kind of paper mistakes, instead of just, like, getting it corrected, they're now sending the sellers to jail. And so some gun shops have been closing down. I think I've heard of three, but I'm not exactly sure. That's the only ones that I know. There's probably a lot more than those three, but they've shut down because they don't want to risk like the tiniest mistake that normally would just be corrected and sending them to jail.
And so why would the ATF do this?
I think
What do you think?
That's a question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. We'll keep going with your story and see if we can flesh it out here.
Yeah. So I think from like my view, and I think a lot of shared views as well, can see this as kind of like almost an attack on our right to bear arms, but not directly, more of a, like an indirect kind of thing. Because, I mean, of course, if you, like, have some huge violation on, like, if you're going to sell a gun to a criminal and lie and say that, no, their background is perfectly good or something like that, I mean, obviously, that's not going to be good and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, or if you do something that's actually criminal, but if there's, like, a tiny, like, paperwork mistake of some sort, obviously, they should not be sent to jail.
So that comes under what they call the chilling effect. You know, you make an example of somebody and everybody else falls in line, and maybe they'll give up their rights when they don't have to. They don't want to push their rights because it's you know, it's like, why do we have a Second Amendment, but there are places in the country all over the place where people do not carry a concealed firearm because, you know, it's illegal by statute, but the supreme law says that we have a right to own and carry firearms. And no government entity can take that right away, and yet people don't carry, even though there's a bogus law below that. So that's what they call the chilling effect. So you see how that would apply here?
Yes.
So yeah. Why would the ATF do it? Let's get back to the main question.
I think, I mean, the most obvious reason that I can think of is to, of course, you know, limit gun sales, limit
mm-hmm.
gun ownership,
mm-hmm.
empower the government, depower the people. There's actually a video. I'm going to try and find it and see if I can play it on here.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if this works very good at all. I probably should have sent this to you beforehand. But
well, we can't play copyrighted stuff, but if it's but we can play what you got? Is it a news story or what is it? Try it out.
It was actually a post.
Okay.
And somebody was talking about the power of guns, that of us having them. Okay. Let me see if I can get this to play.
Okay. As we anxiously await. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You can tell me what the post says, but.
Yeah, okay, ready?
Okay, go for it.
See if this works. Ah.
Yeah, I don't hear anything.
Oh, darn.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Yeah, let's just talk about what it means. But let's get back to the ATF in general. So what is the mission of the ATF?
What I know is that it kind of tracks purchases.
Mm-hmm. So do you know what ATF stands for?
Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
Yeah, they've also added explosives to that too. So we've got a government agency that tracks firearms, and now they're making it, you know, they're threatening to put people in jail for paperwork violations. Why would they do that?
To limit gun sales and limit gun ownership.
So we actually have a government agency.
Though.
Now think about this. Follow this through. We've got a government agency that's purposely going out of its way to violate the Second Amendment, to limit gun purchases, to reduce the number of guns out there, while at the same time, what's the rest of the government doing in Washington as far as guns go?
Sorry, can you repeat that last part?
Sure. What's the rest of the government doing in terms of guns and ammunition, the federal government? Not the military,
just the
government. Yeah. So here's my rhetorical question. Where's this going?
Yeah, and that went right along with the videos I was trying to show, but obviously that kind of flopped because nobody
That's okay.
That.
Hey, I don't mind trying experiments. And then I'll get to Pianchi. I'll get his
yeah.
you know, impression on this. But I want to know, go ahead.
Saying,
mm-hmm.
Like the one thing that's stopping the government, the one thing that's stopping globalization is just the knowledge. Like not even the action, but the knowledge that if every American citizen had a gun, like even just sitting in their closet. Just the knowledge of that is what's stopping the government and stuff. And I think you've even said, like, throughout history, like, one of, like, the main things is, you know, not only the military having guns will help you win, but also the citizens. When citizens are armed, they have such an advantage. Like, the Revolutionary War, that was, like, one of the biggest things that everybody had a gun with them. And
well,
that was really
and not only a gun, but a hunting rifle as opposed to a musket. Do you know the difference?
Like, in how it helps? No.
Okay. Well, this will be interesting technology for you. So not only, you know, does it pay to have better, you know, better people in the spirit, but you also have better weapons than the opposition force. A musket, they used to fire, the British would line up and they call toe-to-toe. You've heard that, right? This lines of soldiers face each other and shoot. It's totally insane. It's an irrational form of battle. And a musket was usually a smooth bore. In other words, it did not have a rifled barrel. So the musket ball did not spin. So they weren't particularly accurate. But they figured the amount of people, you know, it's like shooting, you know, would knock out the amount of other people just because they're all standing next to each other. It's an absurd form of battle, yet it went on for hundreds of years. Now a rifle, a Kentucky long rifle, a hunting rifle, has a rifled barrel. It's got a twist to it. So the musket ball spins. And it's much more accurate over much greater distance. So technology is a huge part in is what made us, you know, win the war for independence. Let me get Pianki on this.
I remember learning about the change, like, from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War. They changed, like, the muskets to add in the spiral path for the bullet.
And it's something called look up the mini ball, which is actually the Meunier ball, the M-E-N-E-T. It's a French word. So somebody developed a bullet that was conical shape, much like our modern bullets today. So they went from the round musket ball to a more pointed round that would go down a rifle barrel. And this is why the casualty rate in the Civil War was so ridiculously high, because the weapons were better. You know, the cannons, the grape shot, which is like shrapnel, and the bullets themselves in the muskets, I mean, in the rifles, were much more accurate, like to 200 to 300 yards. You know, so there were snipers in the Civil War. Technology plays a huge part in this as well. It's worth considering. Pianki, what would you do with the ATF? Here's another rhetorical question.
Well, I would limit their scope for one thing. Weapons can be bow and arrow, crossbow, axe, knife, gun, blowpipe. That's what a weapon is. The bare arm, that could be the definition of arm.
But they're going after the guns. Mm-hmm. So what is it about guns that the government particularly despises and particularly wants? I call the Second Amendment in reverse.
That would be a good idea. You know, it's hard to get into the mind of deviant people that want to take away something from you. Mm-hmm. They threaten to take it away from you. Just like two arguing parents would threaten to take the kids away.
Oh, that's a whole other family. That's a whole other story. Yeah, but there was a Japanese either general or admiral who said we will not be able to, you know, take over the United States because there's too many individual people with gun owners. They knew their troops would never survive in this country for very long. They could attack our Navy and Pearl Harbor, and they could, you know, kind of block us. They tried to block us out of World War II and their conquest in the South Pacific, but they knew they could never invade the United States just for that reason.
Russian assassins use ice cubes. Did you know that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, assassins use all kinds of... Yeah. Go ahead, Brianna.
Back on your question of, like, the ATF's, like, reasoning for this and stuff, I think the reason that they're trying to take away our guns is the same reason why our founding fathers put in there that we should have them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because they made it in order to protect the rights that we have, you know, speech, religion, all of these rights that we have. You have to have a gun in order to protect yourself and keep those. And I think everybody knows that's the barrier to control is defense. You have to have some line of defense between you and tyranny. And they're trying to take that away so that they can have more control over everything else. And so, of course, Americans are going to fight that right off the bat. So I think they're trying to do these little things in order to make it harder and more difficult until it's impossible, and then they can start taking it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at Democrat-controlled cities. I mean, there's your future in the, for the rest of the country. Let me ask you a question on the Second Amendment, because we usually focus on the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. In other words, they can't touch our right to keep and bear arms, and that is absolute. But the first part, a well-regulated militia being necessary, and this is the word that I focus on, a lot of people don't, being necessary to the security of a free state. What does that mean? What's that mean to you? A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. What do you think?
I would think any sort of military, whether it's like, you know, the United States military or, you know, like state, like individual National Guards, or any kind of defense that the people have. I think that also goes with, like, the foreign and domestic kind of idea. It's not stated in the Second Amendment, foreign and domestic, but I think it can also go along with that of, you know, having a defense against your enemies, home in a way.
Well, let's focus on the beginning. What is a well-regulated militia?
Like an army or, like, a military of some sort. But I know sometimes, like, in the Revolutionary era, they distinguish, like, the Continental Army versus a militia as, like, the militia is, like, a smaller, more kind of messy, not as organized as Continental Army, but they actually held, that's what I'm looking for, physically were extremely helpful in a lot more situations versus the Continental Army. Whenever they, you know, were actually more helpful, if they weren't, then, of course, they were useless, but... So I think when you add, like, a well-regulated to it, I think it takes that and makes it into, like, I think in my, like, evaluation of it, it takes something that's really good and useful in, like, a military sense and refining it.
This is something I think you're going to want to do some research on. Pyonki, do you want to tackle the first part of the Second Amendment?
A well-regulated militia. Is the people.
Yeah.
It's the people. It's the people who's armed, and they are regulated in their operations on what it is they're trying to achieve. It's the people.
Yeah, this is what most people don't get unless you look in the Second Amendment. And the government's not going to teach you because they don't want you to know this. A well-regulated militia is specifically non-governmental. So it's not the National Guard. It's not the Army. It's no branch of the military. It's no branch of government at all. It's specifically a civilian organization. Now, you may not have heard this term, but the soldiers back in the 1700s weren't called infantry. They weren't called soldiers. They were called regulars. So if you had regulars and irregulars. The irregulars would be not the regulars. The regulars would be the government army soldier. So if you were regulated, you were equivalent to a regular. In other words, a citizen would have the same arms, the same equipment, the same powder, same ball, the same, you know, musket balls, the same rifle as an infantry soldier. That was what made them well regulated. They were equivalent to the regulars. So you had a non-governmental citizen army. Now, given that context of a well-regulated militia, a group of citizens forming their own military force, independent of government, equal to government soldiers, is necessary for the security of a free state. Now, how does that change your view?
You know, one other.
Yeah, hold on, Pyonki. Hold on. I want to get Brianna on this. Go ahead, Brianna, first.
I think that really makes a lot of sense. I mean, I knew the context of, like, you know, of course they were all, like, citizens and stuff. But I think you really highlighted that point very well of what it really means of giving power to the people in that
situation. Okay. Pyonki?
You should study Texas and the Alamo. You had 200 well-armed citizens that held off 4,000 Mexican army. Then they had reinforcements that came from Arkansas to help them. During the Mexican-American War, you had citizens that would walk as far away from New York down to Texas in the U.S.-Mexican War. Those were citizens, really. And you did have some army, but initially you had citizens. When the British burned the White House and they was marching to New Orleans. Along the way, you had citizens that fought them, as well-regulated militia.
Brianna?
Yeah. I also think that's kind of like what spurred on like a voluntary kind of military system. I think it was part of, now I don't have any proof of this. This is just kind of like my own personal evaluation. These are not like facts. But I think that it might have spurred on from that same kind of idea of, you know, people that are volunteering because of the patriotism and the hope that they had, and that they wanted to defend this country and what it could become. Now, obviously, there's a lot less patriotism.
So that's an interesting question. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I think it's a good thought. But from what my reading of history is that the draft was so unpopular during the Vietnam War, they had to switch. But they wanted to keep the war going, so they went to an all-volunteer army, an all-volunteer military. So I think it's out of public pressure. Because the protests for Vietnam ended when the draft ended, not when the war ended. The Vietnam War went on 3 years after the draft ended. But nobody was protesting because they didn't care if people volunteered to go to something that a lot of people didn't think was justified, me included. But it was when people were forced to go, that's what caused the protest. That's what I think that kicked off the all-volunteer military. But let's get back to but given what you now know, about the Second Amendment, that the founders actually thought it was necessary. It was a requirement for us to belong to a citizen militia to keep our states free. That changes everything. So,
yeah.
so should the ATA? Well, go ahead. Tell me what you're thinking. And I'll get back to Pianki. Given that,
yeah, I mean, even the Minutemen were citizens, weren't they? And they were like one of the, I believe they were like the most popular force.
But there's a recent one, too. Actually, there's a couple of them. For a while, militia people were at the border earlier. I don't know why militia, not Texas and even Florida militia and anybody along the border state, Arizona, any border state. I can't believe that the governors haven't organized militia to stop this invasion. The closest thing is the governor of Arizona who put containers, actually built a container wall to block the invasion. But the most recent one I remember of taking up arms against the government was the Bundy Ranch. Do you remember the Bundys? Did you hear about that?
No, I haven't heard about that.
Okay, it'd be a great case study. Pianki, do you know about the Bundy Ranch? Do you know what happened?
Yeah, that had went on throughout history. I tell you, a good series that used to talk about gun rights was the TV series Bonanza. Look at some of those old episodes, and you see with Ben, the father Ben and the brothers, they talk about we got guns, especially when the railroads was talking about taking over some of the Ponderosa, which was their land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge point. Brianna, if you want to take some time and study eminent domain and whether you think that should be constitutional or not. It's in the Constitution, but it should be there. That'd be a great question. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes. Of course, you're welcome to stay longer if you can. I love having you on the show. Anything else we should cover from last week? Do we have time for another topic? I want to make sure we get as much as we can. This is fun.
Yeah, I don't think we have time for the other ones. The other ones are kind of even older. But
okay. Well, give me a big question. Let's see what we can do with it. Because if not, I have a question for you.
Okay. So with the ATF situation, like going back a few steps, whenever they did this, I don't think it's in any kind of like bill or published law. And I think that's part of like how the ATF kind of operates almost outside of the law and outside of the boundaries in this way. Mm-hmm. And so would it be illegal for them to establish or enforce this, or would it be perfectly legal for them to just enforce this as a regulation that they make?
The Greg's fell off. the ATF makes up regulations that can be really, really ridiculous. One regulation is the length of the barrel of some rifles or shotguns. And I guess it's under the pretense that you will be able to hide it. And they limit the limit to like 18 inches. But what is 18 inches to a midget compared to a person that's 6 foot two?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? And then they don't want you to be able to design and build your own weapons without that coming under the regulations set by them. Like using 3D printers, for instance, or building out of plastics or more formidable material. So I would limit them a lot.
So would that be something like, for this, would that be considered a crime against like the rights of the people if they were to enforce this?
They make rules and regulations. And they change the definition. They create words to change the definition to suit their purpose of restricting your liberties is what they do.
Yeah.
See, when they start, for instance, like tobacco, alcohol, when they got to the point where they regulated alcohol and they put a federal stamp on it, which is a taxation, then that gives them, opens up the door for them to create other regulations like the legal age to drink alcohol, for instance.
I'm back. I'm on my cell phone. Blog Talk kicked me out again.
They're scared of you.
So I was telling her, you know, you talk about ATF, Greg.
Right.
And I say that the regulations they impose restrict the ownership of guns. Like, for instance, the length of a shotgun. It can't be shorter than 18 inches. Well, if it's 18 inches, they figure that a person 6 foot can hide it. But what about a midget?
Well, I got a better question. Why do we have an ATF? It's unconstitutional. You know, if you cannot touch the right of people to keep and bear arms, in other words, own and carry, why do you need an ATF? They're an unconstitutional agency. They shouldn't have a budget. The Republicans, when they come in, the gelding Republicans, when they come in under my new term, you know, Kevin McDeepstate, that's what I'm calling him now. It's hard to say it, but it's funny. Kevin McDeepstate, they should abolish the ATF. And there have been moves to do that, but the Republican geldings never actually do it. There's no reason for an ATF. It's crazy. Why do we have one? They don't do anything good.
That's the question of the year.
Well, yeah, well, answer
I think
it.
If they wanted
abolish
to do
them.
Something very – I think
the
if they really wanted to do something helpful to the people, they could really handle the fentanyl crisis.
Well, no, actually, that's the DEA. That would be the Drug Enforcement Agency. But you notice they're not doing anything. The Border Patrol's not doing anything. In fact, nobody's doing anything because it's more valuable for the Brandon insurrection, the coup, the illegal government presently in the White House, to flood this country with illegal aliens than it is for the Americans that are killed. They're trying to replace Americans anyway. Why would they care about fentanyl? Fentanyl helps. The more American patriots they can get rid of, the more illegal aliens they can bring in, the closer they'll get to a peasant class, and we'll be another third world country. That's what's going on here. So let's be blunt about it. Brianna?
Well, it's good.
Okay, I thought so too. But the purpose of the ATF is to disarm Americans. And the reason, let's get back to your initial point when you were talking earlier about the idea that they're not, there's no law. They didn't make a law. They made a regulation. Well, regulations should all be voted on by Congress. This wasn't. All they do is publish it in the Federal Register, and if nobody objects, if Congress doesn't object, then it becomes a regulation, which is equivalent to law. Well, that's bogus. That whole procedure is unconstitutional. So let's talk about how regulations are made. There's no justification for the ATF. There's no justification for what they do. Their sole purpose is to disarm Americans through backhanded means to make it more and more difficult to own firearms with registration, background checks, you know, checks on the people doing it, paperwork violations, all this other crap. It's death by bureaucracy. The whole purpose of the ATF is to kill the right to keep and bear arms by bureaucracy, by regulation, by making it tougher and tougher and tougher. There was even a proposal for a $100 tax per bullet. It was Daniel Patrick Moynihan several years ago. That's what the ATF does, and that's why they should not exist. There's no constitutional basis for it. In fact, there's a specific prohibition against them.
What she should,
Pianki, go ahead.
What she may want to do is study how a law, should I say, an act, ACT, becomes an act. It starts off as a bill, and it's usually directed to one of the standing statutes of the United States. For instance, like number 26 is the Internal Revenue Code. It starts off as a bill that's introduced by a congressperson. It could be great. Then once they approve it by both houses, it becomes an act that applies to a particular sector of the United States. Like number 26 is Internal Revenue Service. Number 42 is immigration. Now, here's where it comes into the regulation. Code of Federal Regulation, CFR. The head of that sector, the head of the IRS, will read the act. Then, by his interpretation of what the law says, he would make regulations for Internal Revenue Service. Now, you citizen, if you figure that it's not right, you have the possibility of challenging it in the court, where you would say that this regulation goes against the law. And then, therefore, the court, the judge, gives an opinion.
And then we got Josie on the line. We're going to get to her report in just a bit.
Yeah, and I definitely learned a lot about regulations today. I knew about the bills and stuff. Actually, I was looking up because I'm trying to do, like, a welfare bill because, obviously, abolishing it is something that's probably not going to pass anything. So I'm trying
to create major
restrictions.
Brianna, we have a bill to abolish welfare. Go at writeyourlaws.com.
Oh, of course.
Look at all proposed laws. It's one of the early. I'm sorry, what was that?
I said, of course you do. There's one for everything.
See, you are getting those. Yeah, so go check out Chris Barra's bill. It's in the beginning of the. It's all proposed laws. It's from about 2 or 3 years ago. Chris wrote this, and it's a 25-year plan to get rid of welfare. Take a look at that and see if you want to change it, modify it, write your own, or whatever you want to do with it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know you can't, just get a bill out and say, abolish it, but I think if he has, a plan of it, of steps or different bills and stuff, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to, create a bill with major restrictions that's passable.
Okay. Or you could,
but whenever
thing,
I was doing my research.
Yeah.
And when I was doing the research and stuff, it was the same kind of system that Pianki was talking about, where it's, in different sections. And there's, I literally found information on this in some, just off tax thing that had really, nothing to do with it, except for, a tiny little, in the middle of it. Those things are what's frustrating. Let me tell you. Those
I got a question for her that she can think about.
Okay.
A congressperson in the state of Texas who wants to introduce a gun regulation because that congressperson district has a lot of crime. But being that there are federal laws she wants to put in place, I'm giving it away, really. They want it to apply throughout the whole nation. Is that right? I am Missouri is not suffering from that problem that they are in their district. So why are they trying to impose a law on me in Missouri, and I don't vote for them in the state of Texas?
Yeah, I definitely think anything pertaining to states specifically should stay up to individual states and shouldn't be a federal decision. I think that's also a view shared by, majority of Americans as well.
See, I don't think, back to regulatory agencies, don't bring Josie. Josie's line's live. She's been listening for a bit. I don't think regulatory agencies should be allowed to initiate regulations. They have to come from Congress. And if an agency does want to do that, they can file a bill and see if members of Congress pick it up. But the idea that a regulatory agency by itself can write a regulation, and if nobody objects, then it becomes law simply by publishing in the Federal Register, that's how we got the COVID mandate. The COVID mandate was never voted on by Congress. It was simply put in the Federal Register by the head of Health and Human Services at the time, who now works for Pfizer, by the way. I'm pretty sure that, or the FDA head does, one of them does. Anyway, but that was just put in. There was no bill in Congress. So that mandate that we're under, that Brandon keeps signing, was never voted on by Congress, and that's wrong. So I don't mind
if really
they were coming from a law, but they can't just make it up themselves. They can't start it. Then we'll get Josie in here.
That was a mandate nobody had to follow, really. People didn't have to follow that.
Right, exactly. That's another story. All right, Brianna, why don't you go ahead, and then I'll get Josie. Well, we need to – you can stick around, but I want to get Josie.
I agree with that point that you're making, and I don't exactly know, like, how many bills or anything that different governments have to go through, but I know, like, one of the things that I've learned is, like, the government has so many different bills and – or laws or any kind of problem or case to get onto the House and stuff. If any of them don't actually touch, like, that session of that year of sessions or whatever, then they just, like, go away and you just, like, restart from the very bottom. So I think part of that is, like, to bypass all of that, but also it's extremely dangerous because it kind of, like, almost – that means that, like, if, like, Congress and stuff doesn't say, like, no, that's not illegal, then it becomes law, right? Or the regulation becomes almost like the law. And it might not be because, like, Congress decided not to go against it. It might just be because they never got to it, or it was never, like, brought to them, or just any kind of different things like that, just based on what I've learned. That's a really big possibility that can be a hindrance to, like, the actual process of how legitimate these things are.
Yeah, but see, I want positive action, not negligent action. And the fact that they did nothing should not make a regulation become law. It should take positive action to make it a law first. Then you can make a regulation from it. All right, let's get to Josie.
She started off as a poor child in Nicaragua, living under communism. And now she is a prosperous small businesswoman with a great family, living the dream as an American citizen. Josie Cossey knows all about both worlds, communism and freedom. She knows where your dreams can come alive and where they can die very quickly. And so her report is as much from experience as knowledge, and her passion and crusade are very real. With connections all over Central and South America, Josie brings you the world south of the U.S. border from personal experience, living, not just reporting, what's happening. And now, the Latina Report with Josie Cossey.
Hey, morning, Josie. Feel free to jump into what we're talking about or change the subject or
do whatever
you want.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the
show. Buenos días.
Dobre otra.
Buenos días, Brianna.
Konnichiwa.
Dobre. How are you, Brianna?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good.
Yeah, I was going
to have to go
to it. Okay, well, if you have to go, you got to go, chica. So, God bless. Have a blessed day, okay?
All right,
you're doing
bye.
Good.
Have fun.
Every week it gets better. Thank you.
Thanks, Brianna. We'll talk to you next week.
Merry Christmas. I was listening a little bit. Feliz Navidad.
Feliz Navidad.
Yeah, Feliz
Prospero
Navidad.
Año e felicidad.
Feliz Navidad, yeah. Yeah, I was listening a little bit.
I wish
yeah,
you were Merry Christmas.
During COVID.
I'm going to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Merry
I was singing
Christmas.
The song.
Oh, you were
Bianchi
singing
thinks Jose Feliciano.
Jose Feliciano. I think I was 5 years old when that song came out, something like that, man. It's like
probably.
long time ago. It was very
Prospero
cute.
Prospero año y felicidad.
Nuevo. Prospero año y felicidad. Mm-hmm.
We'll all be home Jose Feliciano. Yeah.
Yeah, I was listening a little bit. You guys were saying Congress did not sign a bill to mandate all this COVID fraud that we've been going through. So it's pretty sad.
That's right.
You know, it breaks my heart. People are still dying from this. My husband at the coffee shop that he goes and spend a couple hours every morning with all the guys, I think he's kind of like the young ones. Most of them are 80 years old or over.
Wow.
One of the young men was there yesterday. Well, not too young, but he was very angry and upset that his friend's wife went and took the second shot, and she died right after the shot. Right after the shot, she's dead.
Oh, no.
I'm like, are people stupid? Oh, my God, this is horrible. But you know, Greg, every day about this, and they respond on a lot of people, well, I guess population control. Are you stupid? You want to be part of that population control gone, vanished from the earth? It's just the way it kind of bothers me when people say, well, I guess they want population control. Like, well, I guess I'm out of here. It's so stupid. People don't think. I don't know.
Well, those are the people, if they arrest all patriots and put us all in a gulag, they'll be like, well, they probably deserved it. I mean, that's that same mentality.
Yeah. Because
so don't count on those people to help us out.
You're right. Some people go, so what did the Trump supporters do? Did they invade the Capitol? I said, no, I was there. They didn't do that. They did it. They planned it. They're well organized, the whole thing. But anyway, let's talk about other stuff because we talk about this every day just about.
So let's talk about what you want to talk about. Yeah, go ahead. What's happening?
Well, I want to talk about the Pope.
Oh, good
the
topic.
Pope,
yes, please. I want to hear all
about
this.
The Pope is resigning, and this is kind of like unusual. Well,
okay.
My opinion is he's going to be arrested, so he's stepping down because he thinks he's going to get away with all the crimes. And, you know, he hasn't been there long enough from Argentina, but he's responsible for a lot of child trafficking, money laundering. It's the biggest money laundering from the Vatican. It's just sad. So he's stepping down.
Have you been to the Vatican? Have you ever been to the Vatican, Chelsea?
Actually, no.
Okay.
No.
I have.
I'm not.
I got there. Yeah. I got in Rome Easter Sunday and actually went to see John Paul II give Easter benediction. It was fabulous. But the Vatican's huge. There's money there. It's an entire – it's a city.
They got an empire.
It's a worldwide business. So tell me about – I want to know more about the Pope. I should ask Wendy about this for Wednesday. But tell me – now, were you raised Catholic coming from a Central American country?
Of course. All the Latino people are raised Catholic. That's the only thing you know. You know, even though they're a bunch of crooks, I remember that the United States used to send, tons of milk, like in dry milk, you know, powder milk to Nicaragua to give to the poor people in the neighborhood. I was one of their child. And the church will give it to all their families, the nuns, everybody in the church, but not to the poor people like us. And then when they
feed me, not thee. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So what happened is that after maybe 6 months, they figured they had way too much milk stored away for them. So finally, when it became like a piece of stone, finally they will give us a box for each family. And we were like so excited. I remember cutting the dry milk with a knife that it was so hard like a rock. And then it will stick into your teeth, you know, because we just ate it like in little balls, you know, like as we cut it with a knife.
You told me about this. I remember this.
Yeah,
story.
It is hard. It's sad.
Yeah.
That's what they do. Like when the United States sent tons of potatoes to Nicaragua for the earthquake, you know, in 1972, tons and tons and tons of food and things. They were making you, in order for you to get any potatoes, in order for you to get any black beans or anything like that, you have to go in the street and clean the street or pick up dead bodies in order for you to get a certain amount of potatoes and beans to eat. Yeah.
Wow.
You have to work
for it. I believe
it. If not, they will not give it to you. And the United States sent it for, like, relief for the people to not to starve. These people are dictators and communists, Sandinistas now. It's bad. At the time, it was Somoza, of course, 1972. But it's the same thing all over the world. You send money to Ethiopia and all those countries, it goes in the pocket of the government, the money, and the food goes for their families. And that's why when I made my first trip to Cuba, and, you know, the churches are nice over there. They're very poor. I brought a couple suitcases full of stuff, and the only thing for me was in my little carry-on. I wanted to make it by, you know, even though I like my little makeup and all that stuff, but not in Cuba. You have to be humble. Yeah. So I opened both suitcases, and I wanted everybody in the church to make a big line, and I was handing out stuff to everybody. And they didn't like that too much because they want to be in control to decide who gets what and when. And I did it differently. I want to make sure the people, about 60 people were there, let me tell you. And some of the people didn't get much, so I gave them a little bit of money. So everybody got something that day, Greg. And that's what I wanted to see. The people got something in their hands. Not the pastor being in charge, you know.
Yeah.
So
what's interesting, we talk about a separation of church and state in this country, which, of course, is bogus. Mm-hmm. It's not in the Constitution. But you look at the Catholic mm-hmm. Church. They're acting like a state. They're acting like a state government. So the churches, you know, around the world, the Catholic churches are like branches of the Catholic government.
Yes,
The way they're controlling resources, distributing resources, that's exactly what a corrupt government would do. So a Catholic church in a third world country is like a third world government unto itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you go to Spain, Toledo, or Seville, or Santiago Compostela, which is closer to Portugal and in Spain, and uh-huh. they're next to each other. What a corruption, man! The gold on those churches. Oh my Lord, they could feed the whole country with the gold that they have in Spain that they stole from Peru. You know that they stole so much gold.
Oh yeah, that's why I've been Vatican. The Vatican has more. Gold and finery and marble, and it's unbelievable. I mean, if you try to put a price on the Vatican, it's staggering.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of money.
But
you know, plus all the real estate.
Talking about the Pope. Yeah, go ahead.
Uh-huh.
Talking about the Pope.
Who is this guy?
He's a radical left communist from Argentina, because a lot of the people from Argentina, not everybody, but many are left. That's where they headed. They're lefty, and that's what this Pope is. And a lot of the Catholic people that I was praying at the abortion clinic, most of them are Catholic, and there's a lot of people that do not like the Pope. They want to see him gone, literally. Yeah. This doctor that I pray with, he's on my Facebook, him and his wife, but him comes more. He's a doctor. By day and on the weekend, he's a pro-lifer with his big signs and everything, and he's really a pro-life. He cannot stand the Pope. No, he said, that's no good. He's no good at all. So for a Catholic, very involved in his church and everything, it's a big thing for a Catholic to say the Pope got to go. And when I went to the Ukraine, I was just teasing. I told my Ukrainian pastor, I said, the Pope smokes dope. And the pastor did not know much English at all. And he was repeating and repeating, Pope smokes dope, Pope smokes dope. And I'm like, oh. I said, oh, my God, what have I done? I said, no, don't say that.
Here's the question. If you can give me a little history lesson, because I'm not as familiar. The Pope I remember was John Paul II, the good one, the Polish Pope, who was brilliant, who was wonderful, who I saw live, you know, back in 1982, and I was bumming around Europe. I just happened to get to Rome Easter Sunday. I was lost track of time. I didn't even realize until I got there. I had a hard time finding a place to stay. But do you remember the Pope since John Paul? Because there's kind of like a gap in my knowledge here, and maybe Pianchi can fill in it too. But do you remember the Pope since John Paul? Because he was the best.
Well,
he helped with solidarity, you know, and then they just kind of changed.
I haven't paid much attention because when I was 16 years old, I left. I cut the umbilical cord of the Catholic Church, so I didn't care. I didn't pay attention much of it. So to me, they're all corrupt. All of them have babies on the side. All of them. They have children. And the reason I depart from the Catholic religion because I was almost 16 years old in Peru and with a little boyfriend, and I wanted to kiss and hug and all that. And he was staying at the church in Lima, Peru, staying in the dorms. and we just wanted a hug and kiss, and he wanted to become a priest to please his parents, not because he wanted to, because he was in love with me. So we went everywhere, and the priests, nuns, they were everywhere. I'm like, where in the heck are we going to hug and kiss, you know? So we found a place. We found a place in the basement of the church in Lima, Peru. It's called San Francisco, the church. And we were in shock as we opened the doors to go and hide and kiss. We found a bunch of baby bones, like the nuns were aborting all their babies in secret.
Oh, my God.
So, and it's still there, and a lot of people from Peru know about it. We talk about it with some of my friends. So there were a lot of baby heads, little legs, little arms, and we were, like, in shock as young kids because I was 16 and he was 17. And from that moment on, he left the church. He no longer wanted to be a priest. And I no longer wanted to be part of that cult ever again. That was it. But if you go on YouTube, there's a lot of reports, over 50, maybe 70 by now, really good men that they were like to be a priest. They left the priesthood. They're no longer Catholic. And they talk about it. And there's other videos that I have seen. Over 10,000 illegitimate children from different popes and different high-end Catholic men in the church at the Vatican. So God created men and a woman to reproduce, not just for you to be alone. I mean, it's your choice if you never want to get married. But there's a lot of corruption with the nuns. There's head honcho nuns that they take over, and it's all corrupt. It's all corrupt. And like I said, the biggest money laundry is Ukraine, and the second biggest one, or bigger, is the Vatican. But they're all going to get shut down. And if you notice, big head honchos like the Twitter stepped down a little bit, Facebook, Amazon, big corporate head honchos are stepping down. Fauci's going to step down, he says. Now the Pope is stepping down. They're all going to be arrested, and they think they're going to escape, but no one will escape. There's not going to be a place in the earth where all these people can hide. There's none. Because once the whole truth comes out about all the corruption and the child trafficking, adrenochrome, and all this gun and drugs and trafficking that has been going on for years and years and years, these people are not going to have a place to hide ever, ever. They think they will by stepping down. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen at all. But, yeah.
Well, I got a question from the Catholic Church. I've never understood, because it's not in Scripture. You know, it's not part of the Bible. That church officials have to remain celibate. They can't marry. They can't have kids. They have to lead this totally unnatural life. And because they have to lead this unnatural life, they behave very unnaturally. You know, they become pedophiles. They become child molesters. They become, you know, all these horrible things. They have kids anyway. They're having sex even though they're not supposed to. So what happened to the Catholic religion? Why didn't they do what the Protestant religions do? And you know, the Baptists and the Protestants and the Congregationalists and the Methodists and the Unitarians and all the branches of Christianity except the Catholic Church. I think they can marry. Maybe the Episcopalians can't. I'm not sure because they're almost Catholics.
Yeah, they can.
But other than that,
It's all a religion, tradition, and routine, all of it. Look, back in the old days, they tortured people on a stake because they wanted to read the Bible, and they didn't allow for you to read the Bible, the Catholic Church. It was a no-no. Only the priests were allowed to have the Bible, you know, in their hands. And I remember as a child, Greg, that my parents wanted to make sure me and my sister, the oldest one, us, but the older two were already gone out of the house. But the oldest in line were my sister and me. My mom and my dad made sure they gave us like a peso. With one peso, we wanted to go to church. But we really didn't care much about the church. But we were so hungry when we were kids that we knew it was like paying us off. So by getting that peso, we will share 25 cents each and give 50 cents to the church. We never gave the dollar to the church. We ate ice cream on the way out of the church. We made sure we exchanged the money. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why we really went to church, me and my sister, not because we wanted to. And my mom and dad never were an example. They never went to church. Never, never. And they were so-called very Catholic, but they didn't have a clue about anything. The nuns were abusing us by beating us up. They were nasty and mean, and they were in control of us and shaking us and whipping us with a ruler in the top of your hand, not in the palm, but in the top. And a lot of times they almost make you bleed. They were nasty, and that's the memory that I have as a child. And when I was in church, I remember this priest preaching in Latin. What in the heck is he doing? We speak Spanish. We don't know nothing about Latin. I remember as a young girl, as young as 7 years old, that we started going to church, that he would preach or whatever, and they said, amen. That was it. That's all I learned. Amen. Because the rest of the
stuff. So this is fascinating. This is another part of the reason I don't understand Catholics, because you've got a Bible that only the priest can have. It's like it's secret knowledge, whereas Jesus didn't preach that. Jesus didn't preach celibacy, as far as I know. Jesus probably had sex, you know. So none of this stuff makes any sense. What the Catholic religion is doing. What's that? Go ahead.
Jesus did not have sex. He was the perfect man in the earth.
Jesus didn't have sex?
No.
Are you sure?
No.
So I'm curious.
I'm sure.
All right. Okay.
No.
But he didn't preach against
it. Perfect.
Okay.
No.
Well.
But now the Catholic Church do use the Bible now that I'm not part of it, which is good.
And they don't speak
it,
and they don't do services in Latin, as far as I know, either. That changed with Pope Pius, I think.
Yeah, they don't.
Pope Pius changed it to English, so that was a good thing. So tell me about Pianki, let's bring him in a conversation. Maybe he knows something about the popes, because I remember John Paul, and I think there's been a couple of other ones before this current one, but they've all gotten progressively more liberal. They've gotten into climate change, and they're doing all kinds of preaching, all kinds of nonsense, and everything else like that. Now this particular pope, you say is into all the corruption. It wouldn't surprise me. How else do you get to be pope? Talking about an inside position. You think that the deep state, we're talking about a deep state, that's the religious deep state in the Catholic Church.
You're funny.
There's deep state and deep church. So let's call the Catholics deep church.
Is Bianchi on?
Bianchi, what do you think of all this? He's there. He's just probably doing stuff. Let's see if we can wake him up.
I started laughing when she said he loved me. So I'm listening.
Well, I didn't see Josie at 15 running into a church basement. I might have done that myself. Sounds like fun.
Heck yeah, I was young and in love.
Wow. Do you ever hear from this person, with Facebook and social media?
He never got married.
Interesting.
He never got married. Huh. He was still waiting for me. And then he was taking care of his mom. But with COVID, I don't know if he's dead or not. I have to find out through a friend, because once in a while he would send a message, happy birthday, since 1976.
Wow.
And I haven't heard for a long time, so who knows? Yeah. And I found my first boyfriend. I seen pictures of him in Washington, D.C., when I used to go to junior high and high school in Washington. I found him, and he's divorced, and he looked old. Oh, my God. I'm like... I seen pictures of him. So it's kind of like me. I'm getting old too, so it's sad. But that's
what happens. But we're still functioning. You and I are pretty much the same age. And I finally found a job I liked. Action Radio. About the time all my friends are retiring. I was like, I'm just getting started. So I got stuff to do. There's plenty of things going on. Warren's back on the line. We had him on yesterday. We were talking economics in the third hour. It was quite a spicy discussion. I'll bring him on, but I want to make sure that, Jesse, we get your report covered first, and then I'll let you two talk. I talked to Warren already yesterday. Well, he's back.
Oh, no.
Well, Warren, when are you going to invite me to your show? I'm on cell phone, by the way, Warren, because the Blog Talk kicked me out. When did they kick him out? I mean, something interesting to find out. Anyway, so back to you. Let's make sure we cover our topics first, and then I'll...
I wanted to talk about the border next. They're coming by the thousands. I mean, it is bad. It is bad. They were interviewing Governor, what's his name from Texas? I cannot think of his name. Did I know who's here?
Greg Abbott.
Abbott. This radical left communist from, I think it was MSNBC or whatever, this old lady. She was interviewing him and talking. She's blaming him and Ron DeSantis for all the illegals flooding the border. She's insane.
That's irrational.
She says,
that's insane. Yeah, you're right.
She goes, oh, they're saying, she goes, that the reason they're coming to flood the border is because you and Ron DeSantis are saying that the borders are wide open. So they are coming because of you. So it's your fault and Ron DeSantis. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
You gotta be
now
kidding me.
Well,
they are coming because
remember,
it's well organized by Obama, the United Nations, and all the radical left leaders, their puppet Obama, Biden, and all these people, and Kamala. That's why the illegals are coming in. And they're coming from all over the world. All over the world. Because they send flyers in different villages, different areas, including some of my family tell me. There's flyers going on that now is the time to come before they get Biden out of office. That's the new thing in Nicaragua and in Salvador and Honduras. That's what's going on. Now,
can you get a picture
of
one of those notes? Can you get something we can post on that? Because that'd be fascinating too.
Yeah,
or maybe a
I'll
translation.
Find one.
Yeah, let's post that. Because
the
problem is, The big challenge is because since they're already here in such numbers, is how we send them back, how we make their life so miserable here that they want to go home and
they
fix
will.
Their own country. I mean, that's the
they
challenge.
Trust me.
I said something to Jonathan. Yeah, I said something to Jonathan a couple of weeks ago. I said the best defense is a really good false accusation. And this is like the standard ploy of the left. They'll accuse, you know, DeSantis and Abbott of bringing in the illegal aliens after they brought in the illegal aliens. It's like when they say you can't say the government was stolen, and that's said by the people that stole the government. So it's projection.
Yeah.
It's false accusation. It's government by false accusation. It's really pretty incredible. But the border, now the Title 42 was suspended, the revoking of Title 42.
The
Title 42, that's the public health. Yeah, that was done by Chief Justice John Roberts. I'm surprised. What do you think?
Look, John Roberts is corrupt. The reason they're using him for a lot of stuff is because they blackmail him. Every time he turns around, they blackmail you. You have to do this and this and this and that, or else you're going to release all the information. And that's what's happening in Hollywood, Supreme Court, and the military. They do things when you're younger, and they got all the evidence to blackmail you. And then you have to go along with a corrupt, criminal, left, radical Democrats and some Republicans, too, not just Democrats.
Well, that's what Democrats are doing to any Republicans that run. They go back in the past. They go back into junior high. You know, did you do something embarrassing or stupid or you know, on a date when you were, you know, 14?
They videotape a lot of the head honcho militaries, and they have all this dirt, and this is normal. And they've been doing this for a long time, years and years and years. So they blackmail all these people to do whatever they want, like a bunch of puppets. So, but going to deport
J. Edgar Hoover did.
All of them.
J. Edgar Hoover did the same. Remember, J. Edgar Hoover did the same thing to all his political opponents, particularly Martin Luther King. I mean, he had photographs, videos, you know, either false testimony or made up stuff or just false accusations. So there's not much difference between, you know, the Gestapo and the FBI. In fact, there's probably no difference today. But the way that our government has operated in secret against Americans is very much the same as these communist countries and the Muslim theocracies. They all operate the same way. Secret police are secret police. You know, so there's really no difference between them. The only difference we had was that we had a constitution, most of it, you know, so that we had something we could do against, we could take against them. But now people are finding out things more and more. So do you find people are you know, well, here's a question from earlier. You're talking about how people are dropping dead from the vaccine and people are surprised. I mean, we're not surprised because we've been following this. Well, there was something came out just the other day. Steve Kirsch, I talked about this on the show yesterday. Steve Kirsch, who has millions of followers of his Substack articles. I'm going to start writing for Substack. But he came out and he had this poll. He was saying, well, who was the first you know, to announce that the vaccines were bad and that the COVID was a problem. The government, you know, response was, you know, bad. And as it turns out, it was us here at Action Radio, you know, March 2nd with our show.
You and me.
And yeah, and the bill, exactly. And then the bill that I wrote February 27th, you know, saying that the government could only spend half money on vaccines and spend the other half on early treatments because those work.
Yeah.
So we did. We were actually on the forefront of that.
We've been talking about it since the beginning. Yeah.
But we were also the first people censored. You know, that's why nobody knows about us now, because we were censored before we could.
Oh, yeah, I remember they were blocking you so many times. Yeah.
Oh, they're still doing it.
Twitter,
oh, yeah. We'll break
Twitter,
through one day.
Twitter
go ahead.
Twitter deleted me because I said, yeah, right. Biden is getting the real vaccine. He's getting saline. And boom. You're deleted.
Yeah.
So
well, see, with me, they don't
delete
me. They don't delete me. They just block access from anybody finding what I do.
Oh,
so
no.
I have a core group.
I was deleted.
A friend's on Facebook. Yeah, see, I didn't delete me. Well, I, you know, but they usually, but I've been restricting everything else. Well, let's talk about that now, because what it comes to, and I'll get Warren in a minute here, but what it comes to is that the people that are saying that they have no idea the vaccine is dangerous, they have no idea that it's not a vaccine, first of all. It's a gene shot. But there's two sets of news. There's news that we're getting into and using analysis and looking at the facts and looking at the studies and reporting real news. And then there's the fake news out there that people that they think they're calling it real news, and they're getting this propaganda line. Oh, the vaccine is safe and effective. The government wasn't stolen. They believe all this nonsense, absolute nonsense. But they believe it because they don't have anything to counter it, because all of us that are countering it are being censored. So it's like fake news plus no good news. So these people just generally don't know. Well, I can't blame them for not knowing, because they don't know that they don't know. They think they know, and that's how propaganda works. They think they know that the vaccine is safe and effective. They think they know that the government wasn't stolen. They have no clue that it was stolen, that the vaccine is deadly. I was listening to a report this morning on Brian Sicknick. I think Brian Sicknick was killed by a COVID shot. He was the one of the first to die because the Capitol Hill police were the first to get it. Remember when Pelosi, mid-December, said, let's give it to all the Capitol Hill staffers and Capitol Hill police? Brian Sicknick dies, you know, a couple of days after January 6th of two blood clots. But you don't die of blood clots at a protest. You die of blood clots from a COVID shot.
Yes, so many people have blood clots. Oh, I had a lady in my store yesterday, and she said, they're seeing spot on my lungs and, like, blood clots, and it's all that rubbery stuff building in, you know? It's sad.
Have we analyzed those? Do you have any doctor? Okay, Bianca, first I'll ask my question. Go ahead, Bianca, and then I'll get Warren in here, too.
I had a friend just had a heart aneurysm.
Oh, no.
Sunday. He got
COVID
the shot.
Yeah.
He got the shot when it first came out.
But, you know,
and probably
it was
the...
Go ahead.
What was your question? What was your question?
I've forgotten now.
Come on.
I'll think in a minute. But I should write these down. But, no, it's you know, why didn't these people know? You know, why can't, you know, and everybody knew that it was reported that COVID is not that big a problem, that 99.9% of the people are not going to be seriously affected by this. So why, and that did get out early on. So why did people, in fact, I have a CDC chart saying that COVID basically disappeared mid-July of 2020. And then the government brought it back for their lockdowns and policies and masks and closures and panic and anxiety and everything else. They made people so stressed, their immune systems were suppressed until the so-called vaccine came about, which wasn't a vaccine. And then it started killing people. And they've never made the connection. Go ahead.
The agenda is to wipe out half of the world. And this is worldwide. All the countries are in it. So what's going to happen is, in the election, if you notice, all these countries that I have mentioned before, our government is involved, placing who they want in control in each country. But this is worldwide. Let me tell you, this agenda of these criminals. But it's going to be worldwide military takeover coming up soon. You'll see. So anyway, I wanted to know what Warren has to say about COVID shots.
I just agree with you on the military taking over, but I think that people are rebelling. They just don't know how to rebel. And that's our job here. This is the problem with us being suppressed, is we got the way to rebel. We've got the legislation that can fix all this.
Yeah.
We just have to have people get it into the media and then to Congress and then tell them if they don't vote for it, then the elections, you know, they'll be out. All right, let's bring on Warren. Mm-hmm. So Warren is the host of Wake Up New Orleans. He was on yesterday. We're talking economics. And I'm going to let you guys talk. So, Warren, why don't you go ahead and then Josie and Bianchi can you guys can talk a bit. Warren, welcome back.
Greg. How's everything, Greg? And Bianchi, how are you?
Everyone's fine.
Okay, you missed the conversation with Vince on Sunday. Josie, ¿cómo está hoy?
Muy bien, obrigado.
Okay, estoy muy bien también.
What is your take, Warren, on all these killer shots? Any of your family members got the shot?
Yeah, I took the vaccine, and I haven't heard anybody in my family took sick or anything. That's not to say that there may be some health problems I don't know about. They haven't told me, but I mean, I'm fine. I took the two shots, then I took the booster. So
Warren, why did you do that? Were you worried about your health? Were you worried about COVID?
Young
and healthy or what?
According to the information that was given, and that was very prolific, was that it was being said that taking the vaccine would make it less likely that you would contact the virus. And so,
What if you did contract the virus?
Well, first of all, I have not that I know of. I haven't contacted the virus that I know of, but I didn't want to take the chance of suffering whatever consequences one might experience having gotten the virus. So I want to take precautions. So that was something that was presented to people as a preventive measure to possibly make your risk of getting the virus lower. You know, if you caught the virus, your symptoms may not be as bad as those who didn't take it and caught the virus. So I didn't want to.
Okay.
You didn't trust your immune system.
He was just like everybody else.
Then I'm gonna let you go, Josie. You guys can talk. But the psychology is: did you not trust your immune system, and did you not trust early treatments if you got it? So the vaccine was like your only.
No, I didn't trust.
It was your only way, or what?
I didn't trust the virus because I've known people during that period who died. I mean, many people died. Many people died. You know, and so
did they have other factors? Because most people died from COVID were either obese, diabetic, had cancer, had heart disease, were old, had a bunch of other things going on. Do you know any young, healthy people that died specifically of COVID only, not anything else?
Yeah, there were people under 50 died. In fact,
they had no other symptoms that were otherwise normally healthy.
I don't know. I don't know what their health conditions were.
That's the question, though.
Before this. Yeah.
All right, Josie.
Well, real people, because I talk to doctors and nurses daily. It was remdesivir in the hospitals. But the COVID really, really did not kill people, only 3% of people in the world. And that's where we at now. And a lot of doctors are coming forward, a lot of whistleblowers. A whistleblower from Pfizer, which is one of our friends, she's letting it out. And at the beginning, they were deleting all her videos and everything because they don't want people to know. So a lot of innocent people like you were deceived, and you thought you were doing the right thing by protecting yourself and all that. But a lot of people, including some of my doctor friends in Miami, they were lied to, you know, and pharmaceutical. She's a pharmaceutical. She was lied to. So
I had a friend from New Orleans down there, Devin Collins. He took the shot, got real big and heavy, and he died.
Devin didn't take the shot. I knew Devin. Devin did not take the shot. That's what was said when he died, that he caught COVID on the movie set because he was working at a movie set. This movie called Emancipation.
My friend wasn't in movies. He was an attorney. Dave Collins, Dave Marks, he They put him on a respirator, and he died. So, you know, yeah, people are having these effects. CDC says, according to their data, the majority of people that's dying from COVID are those who have had shots.
Yeah, I knew Devin Collins. He used to go to Egypt a lot with Oshawa Kwesi.
All right, well, yeah, that's him.
Yeah, he.
So back to the issues, please.
Yeah, but my understanding was that he caught COVID on a movie set. He was actually working with that movie that's out now called Emancipation that they shot here in New Orleans or areas of Louisiana.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then people wanted to blame it on Trump and say that he could have done more to stop it. Well, what was it going to do, make people? Government's not supposed to make people take shots.
Josie.
¿Qué pasa? ¿Qué pasa?
¿Conocía Miguel Obando y Bravo?
I don't know who that is.
That was the Archbishop of Managua.
Yeah, but I'm not involved in the Catholic thing.
Oh, you're not Catholic. I met him.
Let's focus in a little bit here on the.
Oh, I was trying to go back. I was trying to go back to the religious things he was talking about. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
It's okay.
Well, I want to focus in. We have a guest at 9 o'clock, so we're going to totally change the topic. We're going to talk horses. It's going to be great fun. But anyway.
Hey, horses.
Yeah, I got a horse.
So what happened?
So tell me about the Pope. I mean, where's he going to go? What's the Catholic Church going to do? What do you want to see them do? Do you think we should intervene in what the Catholic Church is doing? I'm curious.
Well, I grew up Catholic. I'm not a practicing Catholic. Now, I don't go to Mass like we used to when I came up. But I wanted to tell Josie that this Archbishop that used to be in Managua, Miguel Obando y Bravo, I met him once in New Orleans because he has family live here. He died in 2018. He was a well-known bishop there in Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm. In Nicaragua.
So when you were there, you grew up in Managua?
Yeah, I grew up in Managua, yes, in the city.
He was the archbishop. He was the archbishop when you were growing up there. Yeah.
Yeah, I left Nicaragua in 1971.
Yeah. Oh, he became the bishop like around 1970, I think. He became the archbishop there.
Uh-huh. I don't know much about it. But
now I got you.
I wanted to know. I wanted to know what does he think about the Pope that he's resigning?
Oh, the Pope's resigning?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that news. That happened, came out this morning.
No, yesterday.
Oh wow! Yesterday. I didn't hear that. That can be several things. It could be several things behind that, you know. But they do have a lot of scandals in the church, a lot of scandals.
Definitely.
Well, this is kind of interesting because you were all set against the government yesterday. You're talking about the class struggle. What about the church as a government? What about the church as a corrupt entity? Are they not taking all kinds of power and acting like a government? Where's our separation of church and state?
Well, the United States doesn't have a state religion. So the United States is mostly a Protestant country, and Catholics have always been viewed as the outsider in the United States. We
like
see
John
that
Kennedy,
when,
too, and the Kennedy family?
Well, you know, that was when he was elected. That was a concern among people that he would be, he would be loyal to the Pope. But that was a religious prejudice that we had in this country. You know, you had prejudice against Jews, you had prejudice against Catholics, and so that's what that was. But we had no Catholic control in the United States because we have no state religion here. Now, in other countries, the church wields a lot of power in other countries.
I thought a lot in America.
Maybe I'm confused. Take, for example, where I live. I live in New Orleans. So this traditionally has been a Catholic stronghold because the Catholic Church, they own a lot of property in the New Orleans area. but they don't pay taxes on the property. So the Catholic Church here has influence because many people have always been Catholic because of the French and Spanish colonial legacy that we had. So it depends on what region of the country. And like cities like New York and Philadelphia and Boston, where you have a lot of Irish, you probably had influence. But for the most part, the Catholic Church hasn't had any state influence in terms of like a state religion, like it would have been in, let's say, Spain or Mexico or some other place, you know?
Well, wait a minute, Warren, you just told me yesterday all about Disney World and that special exemption that's such a wonderful thing, and you're not complaining about the Catholic Church having tax-free property and having all the power they have. I'm just curious.
No, I wasn't bragging about – all I was saying about the situation in Reedy Creek was that DeSantis is in a dilemma now because by threatening to take away that special tax status, that means that that's going to fall on the people in that district. They're going to have to cover the $1 billion in taxes that Disney World contributes to in various services. So that's what I was saying. So they're in a dilemma.
Yeah, here's where I think you're wrong on that, though, because if a company moves, like when a company moves to China, you know, the residents of that community don't have to make up for the tax base. That's absurd. So if Disney World loses their special tax exemption, they actually have to start paying taxes that they're supposed to, or if they move or leave or do anything else, the people around that pay the taxes of a corporation when the corporation leaves. That doesn't make any sense.
I want to see Disney World shut down, period. That's what
Go
I
for
want
it.
To see.
Tell me why. Tell me why.
They're child pedophiles. You're going to see it all coming out. They've been trafficking kids with some of the producers, the people that work there. It is one of the biggest child trafficking in Florida, and the same thing in California. Yeah, they have underground. They have a lot of stuff. And the next one shut down is going to be Victoria's Secret. Because a lot of people feel disgusted now because the secret of Victoria is that most of the models are men. That's the secret. But anyway, a lot of these things, I want to see them shut down completely. Yeah. Child pedophile. If Disney was alive, he would be coming out of his grave right now. What the stuff that's going on. What do you think? They have gay month, the whole month of June in Disney. That's for children. And now all this Nickelodeon, this thing with all these gay things, the trannies, and they want to teach your kids all this stuff, and Disney's part of it. It's sad. It's sick. Sick. I don't support Disney. I want to see them gone. Maybe somebody else can take over once they all go down. But that's what I want.
Warren?
That's what I want for
Christmas. Warren, what do you think?
Josie.
Yeah.
Josie. No veo noticias sobre la el Papa renunció, pero no veo las noticias.
Sí, están. He said he doesn't see the news about the Pope resigning. It was all over yesterday, actually.
I just don't see it. That would be big news. I don't see it in the news.
But it was.
Well, let me tell you. I'm going to take a break here a bit, then we'll get a new guest on the show here. But Rand Paul made a comment earlier about this latest $1.7 trillion omnibus spending bill that the lame duck Congress is trying to lock the next Congress into. I don't think they are, because they can always change the bill as soon as they take office. But this seems to be, you know, surprisingly not in the news. It's another budget-busting, inflation-creating, massive bill that Congress isn't reading, that they don't know what's in it. They're going to be asked to pass it at the last minute so the government doesn't shut down. It's the same old pressure tactics. It's an insane way to govern. I was curious what you all thought of it, because I have a bill to actually counter that. I have two bills, one that would mandate a 30-day comment period for any budget bill over $100 million, and the second one is a constitutional amendment to take away the power of Congress to borrow money. Now, those are two huge topics for 5 minutes, but I'm just curious, you know, where we go from this $1.7 trillion bill and why nobody is talking about as much as all the other stuff. This is the biggest issue. Bianchi?
These tax increases is eating up the mandatory minimum wage. It raised wage to $15. Well, that's ate up. $20, that's ate up. These spending that Congress is imposing has got to be paid one way or the other. And I agree that they need to have their wings clipped with their ability to borrow money. You borrow money on the future backs of U.S. citizens. They got to pay for that.
Yeah, that's a question I was going to ask Brianna today, but we'll get to it another week. But let's get Josie Warren's opinion on that. One of our strongest bills right now here at Action Radio, and you can find it at writeyourlaws.com, WRITEYOURLAWS, writeyourlaws.com, is a bill that's a constitutional amendment. It's very simple. Let me bring it up here real quickly. It basically says, well, I just happen to have it. Oh, I don't have it right there. Anyway, it says that Congress shall no longer have the power to borrow money. It's right there in Article 1, Section 8. Very simple, very straightforward. Oh, here it is. Found it. So this is Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution shall be amended by striking Clause 2 to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Section 8, Clause 1 shall be amended by adding at the end, and Congress shall have no power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, nor to print money to cover expenses greater than revenues. Warren, what do you think?
Yeah, well, that's pretty interesting what you read in relationship to the issue you brought up.
Were you for it or against it?
You know, a lot of times what we're told how this stuff happens, we really don't know how this goes down. You know, when they say they're borrowing money.
Yeah, we do. They borrow money without knowing what's in the bill. It's been reported all the time. Nancy Pelosi even said you have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. We know exactly how this works.
I'm against it. Mm. I'm against it because a lot of this money is for their bank accounts, because a lot of these people, they lost a lot of money when Russia froze a lot of their bank accounts, so they're desperate, all of them. So this is all a scam.
The amendments? Are you against Congress borrowing money, or are you against the $1.7 trillion spending bill? Just to be clear.
I'm against the spending, yes.
Okay.
I'm against.
Get that out there. All right.
Yes.
Now, the question is, what percentage of the national budget or spending takes up a large chunk? And that's defense. If they just passed the $800-something billion budget for the military, you know, and so I'm against all of this spending for the military, where you have
You're for the $1.7 trillion spending bill on everything. Who knows what's in that? But you're against the $800 billion for our defense. I just want to get that out.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, the interest on the debt in four more years would be greater than military spending.
But what people don't understand is the United States, nobody could force the United States to pay their debt the way the United States and the EU can force other countries to be responsible for their debts, such as to the IMF or to the World Bank. So there's no entity that could hold the United States accountable for their debt. So they just could choose not to pay it.
Well, the IMF and the World Bank, if a nation borrow from either one of those countries, they have to put up collateral, and usually the collateral are some form of natural resource.
Right. They have to give up some of their sovereignty in order to get a World Bank loan, IMF loan. They have to give up things like the state assets and stuff like that as qualifications. Or in the case of African countries, one of the preconditions is not to even grow food. You don't grow wheat. Buy our wheat. Buy the U.S. wheat. So don't grow wheat. You want this loan. That kind of foolishness.
Well, this is no fun. Warren, you're much more combative yesterday. This is kind of tame. What happened?
What do you mean combative?
We were kind of going crazy yesterday. It was kind of fun. We were talking about a particular
issue as it relates to we were talking about what the term free market really means in economic terms. That's what we were going back and forth, and I had to share with you the great economist Michael Hudson, who's an economist, economic historian, you know, who's sharing with you.
Okay, let's take that one up again. I want to get you back on that. That's a fascinating topic. But I got a guest coming on who's new to the show. I want to play a couple things real quickly here.
Hey, nice talking to everybody. Got to go too, okay?
Hey, Josie.
Let me say
one more thing, Josie, let me say one more thing. No, I did read where the Pope said he had a resignation letter in the event of bad health. So he had a letter already prepared in the event he gets real sick, a resignation letter. That's what that is.
Nah, he's not real sick, but it's okay. All right, nice talking to you, everybody, chico. God bless you. Que Dios lo bendiga. Ciao.
Okay, gracias.
Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. Do you know your way around healthcare, insurance, pharmacies, surgery, alternative treatments and choices? I don't. Which is why I'm so glad I met Priscilla Romans, had her on Action Radio, and learned about health patient advocacy. She is the founder of Great Care. And now as an affiliate of Great Care, we are proud to offer through our discount code, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws, a 10% discount. Great Care saves you both time and money. They provide medical advocacy, consultation, advice, and recommendations nationwide. Their website is greatcare.com. That's GRAITHcare.com. You can email them at greatcare.adm@gmail.com or call them at 469-864-7149. That's 469-864-7149. Great Care, better health through better knowledge and advocacy. Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.
All right, well, I see some static on that particular one. I might have to record that one again. Anyway, I'm searching Facebook, and I'm just kind of puttering around. I'm looking around for things to see what's on, and I come across this beautiful horse picture. I'm thinking, wow, this is cool. I've ridden horses a couple of times, one time on the beach with my daughter, and I'll tell Candace about that in a little bit as we get to talking. But I thought, wouldn't these be cool folks to have on the show? And I'm looking, and they're in Milton. they're right here. So not only is it going to be cool to have them on the show, I want to, I want to go there myself. And so I thought one of the things we haven't done for, you know, I don't think we have done actually is a show talking about horses. America has a love affair with horses. We have Westerns. We have cowboys, you know, the people are still watching them. Pianchi was mentioning, Bonanza earlier. So I thought it'd be really cool to have Candace on to give us her take on how she got involved in horses and the whole thing about the place what's it called here? Let me see. Well, she'll tell us in a second, but let's see if I can actually do this accurately here. Where did I put it? Here we go. Believe the Journey, Horse Services. And so we'll find out about that. Anyway, let me give her a round of applause here and welcome her to the show. Hey, Candace, I'm on my cell phone.
Hey.
Blog Talk kicked me out again. I gotta talk to him about that one again. Once again, that's why I don't sound like my great normal voice on the microphone. But yeah, I had to call him too. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing good. How are you?
We're having a great time. We've got a couple folks here. We've got Pianchi, we've got Warren, and we'll get to them in a little bit as we get going. But I want to hear from you first and find out the story. We'll start there with the thing I was talking about. America really does have a love affair with horses, don't they?
Absolutely. Way more than what I imagine. You know, as far as, you know, for me, myself, my story was, you know, from a little girl, even though I didn't necessarily grow up with horses, it's always been in my blood. I've always been a rider, and I've always loved horses. I mean, from the time that I could talk and that I could think properly, like, it was horses. I didn't get my first horse until I was 13, and he was a crazy, unbroke, 17-month-old Arabian thoroughbred. And for the people that are listening that know anything about horses, they're probably – shocked that that was my first horse with his personality.
Wow.
But that was kind of the, and I still have him today. His name is Pistol. This is 15 years that I've owned him. And he kind of helped me start my journey through my training. You know, I had a lot of people come into my life at that point to help me, to guide me, because other than the books and the stories and the friends that had horses, I didn't know much, you know, until I was 13, until I was hands-on with it. And I always applaud the parents that take on that big scare of, hey, my kids have this crazy passion of horses and we don't. And we don't really know where to go from here, but they want to see their kids succeed and they want to see their kids go through their dreams. And my mom, you know, at an early age, she got kicked in the face. And so that was a big scare for her. So I applaud her for even allowing me to have that opportunity at that age. And there was a lot of, you know, injuries and a lot of tears and a lot of sweat and a lot of blood that was shed through that. But it, you know, the horses have really kind of came into my life and has just, you know, consumed me really. And I, doing this trail riding business, like, I get to see so many people come in that, you know, as a child, that was kind of their dream too. They, you know, they loved the horses, or they had, you know, they had memories with their horses or friends' horses. And then they come to me as adults and they're like, we haven't done this in 20 years or 40 years or even 60 years. And to kind of just see the expression come back on their face and them to relive the memories of being a child and going out there and being one with nature, like, it's an amazing opportunity. And it's such a blessing for me to allow others to share my sacred place and to share it with the horses.
This is great. I'm just writing some stuff down here. This is fascinating. Because
yeah,
I mean, for anybody that has a passion, they're very similar. I discovered airplanes at 5 years old. I actually got to go on a Vickers Viscount from Toronto to New York. I was born in Toronto. And ever since then, it's been airplanes.
Wow.
I liked it before. I used to watch it as like a four-year-old, but I knew. And one of my hopes here at Action Radio is that it can generate enough so I can buy my own jet and do loops and rolls, you know, over the Gulf of Mexico, because we're both in Belgium.
Yeah.
So I'll trade you a horse ride for a jet ride. So we'll,
absolutely.
So we'll share passions. Do you find that, though, that the people that are passionate about anything, especially if your parents, you know, I think you were lucky enough that your parents let you do it, because there's millions of people whose parents say, oh, that's a stupid idea, or that's a terrible idea. You know, and you didn't have to face that, which is good. Or did you? Was it some objections, or they were cautious, or how did they treat you?
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, I probably asked for a horse or a pony from the time I was 2 years old. And, you know, the funny thing is the first thing that I ever got to ride was a cow with my grandfather's friend, Mr. Boyd. And, I mean, it was like the most, like, I was just so excited. I was up high, I was on something, and I was connecting with the animal. And, you know, I was rejected every year. I mean, I think I asked for horses for my birthday, for Christmas, for any special occasion, or even when my parents were asking me what I wanted to eat for dinner, I was like, I just want a horse. Like, that's what I want, you know?
Forget
so
dinner.
The rejection
Give me the horse.
Was there for 13 years, and I play with people all the time in a joking manner when, when I have families with kids come and they're like, we want a horse. And I tell them, I said, y'all might want to get one now, because as they get older, they're going to have more than just one horse. You know, I have personally right now, I got 13 horses and I board three.
Wow.
And I've kind of always, you know, from the time I was 15, I was working at different barns or I was hands-on with other people's animals and horses. And I spent 11 years at working at a vet clinic. I made my way all the way up to a hospital manager, and it was not until I went to Loretta Lynn's ranch, actually, in Tennessee, and I was there for a whole week, and I was riding, and halfway through that, I was like, you know what, like, I need to come home, and I need to ride my horses. That's what I need to do. I need to not be a hospital manager. I need to ride my horses, and I need to share this with people. And so that's kind of why I named it Believe the Journey. I was going through, at the time, you know, a connection with myself, and even though I had a career set and I thought that was what I needed to do, it just wasn't in my heart. And so I'm glad that I took that leap of faith. And, you know, there is kids out there that are going to get rejected, you know, probably until they're adults so that they can make that decision of their own. But as long as they keep to their dream and they know that that's their passion, you know, the time will come when it's ready, you know. And same thing for me, the time came when it was ready. If I would have had horses as a child, I probably would have had broke horses that were already safe, and I wouldn't have learned the training aspect or the connection on the ground like I have now, or even through the rescuing processes of the abused horses and the emotional, you know, the horses that have went through, you know, home to home to home, that emotionally has been traumatized, to the ones that have came to me that's won $250,000 on the racetrack that couldn't even walk off the trailer when I got them, you know, things of that nature. If I didn't get a horse when I did at that certain time, I wouldn't be where I am today, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. I'm really glad that we connected when I got you on the show. This is fascinating, because people don't think about that. You don't have any news, you know, programs, you know, talk about this, but this is our soul. This is the connection here. Well, tell me about that. A horse is more than a horse. It's not just an animal. I mean, there's
correct,
a serious connection that you have with the horses. And, well, tell me about that. I'm curious.
Well, some people might call me the horse whisperer if you hear my family talk. And, I mean, I joke on it, and I've had a lot of my clients, especially during the COVID time, that people were like, oh, my God, you're Amy off of Heartland, because Heartland, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that show. It's a show based out of Canada. But, you know, and watching that show myself, you know, I could see a lot of reflection of how she felt, and they really captured it so well. They captured, you know, they didn't capture it like most movies and television shows where it doesn't feel real. And that show really made it feel real. And, you know, going out and doing my trail rides and my lessons and my therapy sessions, like that's the main thing. I want people to see the real aspect behind it. And I want them to see the spiritual connection that I have with it and the magic that goes behind it. And a lot of it is based on your energy. And I know that sounds so weird, and some people look at me
not
like
on this
I'm
show.
Crazy.
You know, that sounds all weird on this show. Yeah, yeah. You're
yeah,
my friend,
you know,
here, so yeah.
It really is based on your energy, and when you can find yourself within a horse, it's the most magical, empowering feeling when you connect to them. You know, a lot of people say, gosh, you're like the puzzle piece when you're on your horse, or the people that come to me that I can tell are in tune with their energy. They're like, man, your horses just, they, you know, your horses and your horses know you, and y'all fit the piece, you know, and it is, it's such a magical feeling. And it's not something that I think within us can explain to people that don't have it within them. It's just that feel. It's just that passion and that dedication and spending hours and hours with those horses and connecting them. And not only just horses, it's with other animals as well. I mean, I rescued my dog Traveler, which if you've been following my Facebook page, that's like the love of my life.
Only
it's
recently.
My other soulmate.
You know,
yeah.
I just discovered this, 3 days ago? And here you are.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah,
okay.
This has been pretty quick. Yeah.
So,
that's okay.
So Traveler Traveler is my, I call him my trail boss. He's my dog. I found him in a garbage bag thrown out on 4th of July.
Oh, wow.
And from the time he was 5 weeks old to now he's about a year and 8 months, he has been with me throughout my whole journey with the horses, and people love it. People see the connection that I have with him and the connection he has with me, as well as the connection that he has with the horses. I mean, we go on trail, you'll have to come out, because when we go on trail, he checks on each one of my horses. Yeah, he checks on the people,
yeah.
And he leads the trail, and he keeps us safe. And it's just cool to have people come out and see that connection and have them believe in it.
You know, what's so enthusiastic, what's so good about this, your enthusiasm, your spirit for this, it's really contagious. And I've got Warren and I've got Bianca on the line. I'll invite them on in a little bit here, but I want to talk to you a little bit more myself. Because you mentioned it's infectious. It really is. Because what you believe, I can see other people believing. And even if they're skeptical when they show up, they're going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, knowing more than they're not just there to ride a horse. They're there for an overall experience.
Right.
Spiritual experience and emotional experience. They're there to let go of their misconceptions and go into a world of something that I think we've lost in this country a lot. When I think of, I bike ride a lot. Like, I bike ride all the time. So the closest equivalent for me is that, until I hop on the horses and so you teach me how to do this again. But what's interesting is I did a video of an armadillo, and I spent like two minutes or so, and I watched it for about 10. I did this video, and there were two kinds of folks reacting to it. There were those that said, they have leprosy, they're pests, they'll dig up your garden, they're terrible. I'm like, oh, go away from me. And the other folks were, this is a cool animal. I've never really stopped to look at one. I've never seen them up close, kind of thing. So it's fascinating, the reactions. And I imagine horses are the same way. They should be pulling a wagon or at the racetrack or something like that. But you, it's so much more. And do you find that people go through a change? You know, with you one time or several times, do you see this this is a rhetorical question. Well, tell me about the change that you see. No names or anything, but what have you observed of people?
Oh my goodness. So, I mean, I do have a lot. I mean, I can say probably 75% of my people come back, whether that's once a year or every month, and just seeing them come back to, and I guess it goes to like our rush society and coming out and being able to just relax and take in the nature and really, you know, breathe and connect and be one. And there's, you know, one of my first clients really hit me hard. You know, I kind of second guessed her when she came out the first time. I was like, oh, I doubt she'll come back out, you know. And being a hospital manager, I've learned to really read people, and I'm a Pisces and an empath, so it kind of comes with nature. You know, I really misjudged her. I misjudged her on the first, and then as soon as we got done that day, she's like, I want to come back out. And so she did, and then again, and then she brought her whole family. And after about the third ride, she came up to me, and she was like, I just really want to thank you. And I said, well, you know, I love the fact that you're coming out here, and I get to watch you grow. You know, I get to watch people reconnect with their souls and reconnect and learn new things and get more comfortable with the horses and connect with that certain horse. You know, but one of the biggest things was, like, for her, it was a fear of being out in the woods because of a traumatic incident that happened with her ex-husband, which could have cost her life. And to know that, my horses and myself have allowed her to get through that trauma in her life was just like, it brought me to tears, and it still brings me to tears because it's, I'm doing such a simple thing, I feel like, but it's such a magical thing at the same time. So just allowing people to get out and just breathe and relax and not think about, oh my God, well, I don't know some of these people. They might be losing their home, or they might be losing a family member, or they might be just in their mind and so lost. I had a gentleman that really is special to me. He came for a brief time. You know, he ended up going back. He lives out of state, but, you know, by the end of it, after him coming multiple times, he was like, I have to admire you for you following your dream, and you really helped me get back into, you know, what my life meant to me instead of somebody else. And you've just helped me, you know, you've pushed me over to really do what I need to do and to enjoy my life again. And so I get to help people simply by just allowing them to come and talk with me and allow them to come and connect with the horses. So it's the most it's probably one of the most rewarding feelings I've ever felt.
You know, it's fascinating what you're talking about here. You mentioned therapy sessions. So you actually are in horse therapy. But it's for people, not horses. We're talking about for people. It's actually a therapy that's probably a whole lot better than sitting in an office, you know, saying, well, how do you feel about this? You know, I've never been a big fan of therapy. It never quite made sense to me. I always figured you go do something. With me, I'd go to the shooting range. I you know, when I could, and I want to get back into flying airplanes. Sailing boats. I used to race sailboats with a friend of mine in Marblehead back in Massachusetts. So there's like this zone I get into. So your zone is horses. My zone, I also play music. So, I play a pretty wild electric guitar. And all these things are these zones, these places that we go. And I think we're losing a lot of that now in this sort of computerized phone video game, especially with the younger folks. Do you notice differences? Tell me what you've noticed.
I mean, I can tell you, generationally speaking, I'm 28, and I can tell you 90% of my clients are people over my age, and it is sad. And so I do try to promote the younger generation because we are losing it. We are losing the simplicity of being outside. You know, people don't go barefoot anymore. People laugh at me when I walk the trail sometimes, and I walk it barefoot, and they're just so like, they're like, what? Why is this wild child doing this? And people are losing that connection with nature. They're losing that connection with their own spirit. And it hurts me, you know, like it hurts me to know that we're stuck. We lose so much of our mind because we're taught, hey, well, let's just play on the video games, or let's just stay on the computer and watch TikTok all day. And yes, there's information through it. And I love the opportunity that we have things such as podcasts and such as social media, because it helps us. But at the same time, I think it can hurt us just as much. And, I've had a couple people come to me that were younger than me. Another one that kind of came in my life briefly, and he also moved out of state. And he showed up. He was like, listen, I was born and raised in the city. I didn't find horses until I was down here in the military. And I know for a fact that I'm a rider, and I'm supposed to be on a ranch. And that's my goal. I want to be out west, and I want to be on a ranch. And I just need your help in getting me to that, you know, by allowing me to be with your horses and learning what you do. And I am inspired by stories like that. And I want to push that younger generation to succeed there, because, you know, I kind of started the same way. My parents, you know, they didn't realize this is what I was going to be. And if I didn't have that support from them, I wouldn't be where I am today. So for the generation that's younger, that just wants to take that dive and say, you know what, like, I know this is in my heart and this is what I'm supposed to do, and just take that step and do it, you know, believe in yourself enough to do it. And sometimes it takes that push. You know, a lot of family that comes out, you know, their kids might not have even been introduced to a horse, but at the end of it, they're like, man, I want to do this more often. You know, so not very often do I see where they come out and they've just had a miserable time and they're like, I'm never going to ride a horse again. I've seen more people come out and they're like, oh my God, like, I never realized this could be such a thing. I mean, even people that never rode horses.
But all of it, look what they see. They see movies. They see, you know, cowboy stuff. Mm-hmm. They see sometimes impossible things, or they'll see like big horse races. I mean, there was Vigo, what's his name, did that huge race across one of the Arab countries. I mean, there are some fascinating things. Movies, Seabiscuit. You know, there's a great story. The movie with what's his name, Spider-Man. but yeah, there's let's do that. And then I have one more question about your how you created this whole place, Believe the Journey Horse Services. Yeah. I want to find out about that. And then I want to open up. We got Warren and Napanka. I want to see if they have a question for you. But the horses portrayed movies. Do you go crazy when you see a Western and just like, no, that's not how it works. What are you doing to that horse? How dare you? You'd be like the worst person to watch a Western with, I have a feeling, but I'm just curious.
I mean, I love my Westerns, and I grew up, I watched a lot of Westerns because that was we grew up in the country. So my grandfather, even though he didn't have horses, you know, it was, when we went to my grandparents' house, it was a Western show. Or if I was watching it with my granny, it was a talk show. But, as an adult and going through the journey and reading horses more now emotionally, watching those types of shows and those types of movies, when I'm really in tune with it, yes, there's times that I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, like, you know, but at the end of the day, I know that it's movies, and I think the concept behind it, because I have people come out and they're like, oh, I've seen it on TV, I just want to run the horse. And I'm like, no, we can't just run the horse. Like, this is not a movie. This is a communication factor with my horse. You know, like,
it's real animal.
So much
it's living and breathing.
On TV. Yes,
yeah.
You know. So there is some contradictory to the story behind it, because some people, and again, like COVID with Hartley, and people seen that, and then they researched, I want to go riding. And so that show inspired people to get out and ride. But the way that particular show inspired it was a lot different than, you know, the Western, like, oh my gosh, I want to run Go-Ho and through the water and, you know, rope this cow and all this fun stuff. And I mean, there is part of me that wants to get more into a Western feel. And I actually, hopefully by next year, I will be planning some pack trips, and I would like on a journey for my spiritual connection. So a pack trip is like a through hike, like kind of like backpacking, but you do it off your horse. So I'm going to start in one location and hopefully make it, you know, my longest journey that I'd like to do is probably going to take me about 8 to 12 weeks to do it. But there's also a couple trails like Pacific Crest Trail, some of the Continental Divide there and out west. You know, I want to get deeper into my connection spiritually and really get back to the simple ways and learn all of my senses and do that not alone, per se, as far as having my supporters and having people around me, but alone as in, you know what, this is a dream of mine, and I'm going to pursue it, and I'm going to go out, and I'm really going to dig deep and share my story. And there's a story behind that as well, from a little girl, a man that I met that I actually just recently lost on November 23rd. And he was actually on the Jay Leno show. His name was Charlie Bob Martin. And I met him right after I lost my grandfather, who I was really close to, at the age of 4. And Charlie Bob actually spent 4 years of his life living on the road with his mules. His mules named Ella Lee, and his dog named Dylan and Magoo. And he kind of spread the word. You know, he did shows. His mule would lay down, and they would cover up together. And he rode across the Golden Gate Bridge there in San Francisco, and that's where he met Jay Leno. And he's always been an inspiration to me. And like I said, unfortunately, we lost him November 23rd, but I inherited his mules that he's born and raised, Ella Lee, his famous mule. But there's, you know, it's just little things like that that inspire other people to complete their journey. And I'm grateful for it. So I want to be one of those people. I want to help other people, you know, inspire their journey and really push them to do what they need to do.
Yeah, I was going to say you're the dream inspirer as well as the horse whisperer. This is incredible. I got some questions. I'm going to let me see if Bianchi or Warren has a question for you. I have several more, but I figure if I monopolize the whole conversation, then the hour will be out and they'll be all set. Bianchi, do you have a question?
No, I have no questions.
Okay. Warren?
Yes, I want to say that to your guests, it's very interesting. I live here in New Orleans, and my son and daughter have horses. They have Tennessee walking horses. And here in New Orleans, now, my grandfather was from one of the rural areas outside of New Orleans. And my grandfather, prior to coming to New Orleans, that was his job. He broke horses because that was very a low-level job. But what I wanted to say was, in Louisiana, in the rural areas, it is very popular, particularly among African-Americans. They have trail riding associations. And so we have what they call trail rides. It is very, very fun. It's generally a 2 or 3 day affair. On a Friday, you have your trail riding association has a dinner. They prepare a dinner. And then on Saturday, they have a dance. And then on Sunday is the trail ride. Even the local police departments are carted off the road. And then when the trail ride ends, there's a big party. In fact, if you go on YouTube and type in Louisiana trail rides, you'll see basic videos of African Americans, and that's an image that very few people know about. That in the rural area, trail riding associations are very common and popular in the rural areas here in Louisiana, even extends to Texas, that you have this take place. Yes, and so the many people have horses. Beautiful ladies come out there with trailers and their horses. Everybody's wearing cowboy boots and cowboy hats. And it's been about 2 years. It's been about 2 years since I've gone to a trail ride. But my son, my daughter, they often, when they come back in town, they'll go to the trail ride because their cousins have keep their horses at his stable. And so it's a very interesting. I mean, ever since I was a kid, my grandfather would bring me out to where he was from around the area called Opelousas. And then they were – that was the whole culture, cows and horses. Because Louisiana has that – Louisiana has that Western type culture like Texas does when it comes to horses and cattle.
Yeah, we don't think of that because we think of New Orleans as like, you know, French culture, and then of course New Orleans jazz and everything else. That's interesting. Think about Candace for a second. Mm-hmm. Warren, that's fascinating. I mean, I love stories like this. But Candace, there's a whole world of horses that people don't know about. There's trail rides.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking about extended camping trips and all these different things going on. What is the horse world just not reaching out to as many people? Do you want to keep it with people that really more know what they're doing? What's the story on the things that we don't know about?
And horse people are, I mean, when you're in the normal population and people hear that you're a horse person, it can be traumatizing, and I don't really know the reason behind it. You know, I going through this process and opening up my barn and my sacred place, you know, horses are living and breathing, and there is things that can be created, can be a learned behavior. So it is a constant thing that I have to continue working on my horses, because it's not like a car. Like it's not something I can crank up every day and drive the same way. You know, these horses have a mind of their own, and they are smart, and there is things that you not knowing, not being a horse person, can actually teach that horse how to do, which can result in injuries and can result in bad behavior. And so I think some of it is, you know, horse people, they know the amount of blood, sweat, and tears that are shed, and a lot of these horses are performance bred, and they're here for a reason, a lot of more for athletic reasons and performance reasons. And then the liability behind it as well, you know, the fear of, you know, allowing somebody to get on my horse that doesn't know a single thing other than horses are pretty, and that they want to try this out. You know, it is a nerve-wracking thing, but at the end of the day, I also look back at when I first started getting into the horses and some of the people that I met, the society we live in is so judgmental. And in the horse world, it's judgmental. You know, I didn't grow up with parents that had $40,000 to drop on a trailer or $50,000 to drop on a truck. Like, what I got was, you know, a $1,200 rusted out trailer that it had good floors and we put new tires on it, but it wasn't the prettiest. And in the horse world, I feel like there's so much judgment, and it bothers me so bad. Now, in the trail world, I don't see it as much. But when I was barrel racing, so many of those girls judged me. They didn't even know me. They didn't even take the time to learn who I am. So many people have judged me because I don't have 50 acres of beautiful grass or a cedar wooded barn with an AC and heater in it. You know, I'm just a typical person out there trying my best to work my way up and follow my dream. And I didn't get lucky enough to start with the expenses of it. You know, I bought a pistol for $250. And my mom told me at 13 years old, this is your responsibility. This is your horse. You're going to have to find the money to make it happen. And you're going to have to go out there and feed it every day. And you're going to have to water it and take care of it. You know, and so,
thank you.
Yeah. I was like, okay, what a big dog. But, but it's just judgment. I think a lot of horse people, have moments where they're judgmental, and sometimes we just get in that zone, and just like some people are more animal people and don't have the personality that's needed. I can't tell you how many times people have called into me and they're like, I just want to thank you for being kind or for just getting back with me, because so many other people just don't. And there's times that I'm running from, you know, 6 a.m. to midnight, and people don't realize that that's how busy my life is. But at the end of the day, I'm not here to be rude to anybody. And if somebody wants to come and learn, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, you know, as long as my number one rule is safety and respecting my horses, because it is a job for me, but it's not about the money. And it, you know, a lot of these horses have came to me traumatized and hurt from many hands, and I don't want to ever put that on them.
What are people doing to horses that they shouldn't be doing? I mean, why would you get a traumatized horse? How does that kind of thing happen?
I guess. So this goes into that emotional connection that you have with them.
Right.
Traumatized emotionally, I've had horses that have just been broken, you know. They've been broken to the point where when you look into their eyes, they're just kind of soulless, and it's all because of people mistreating them and people using them for money purposes and not for, you know, the purpose of that they are an animal and they have a spirit and they have a soul. So traumatically going through the emotions of those horses that have either been fear-based trained or they've been beaten or they've been abused or they've been neglected, like emotionally there's such a turmoil that I have to really work through with those horses to get them back to being okay for just anybody to walk up and say, hey. So that's where the trauma comes in. And same thing with people, you know, the difference is they're big animals and people don't know how to read them. So when that horse is rearing up or lashing out at you, a lot of people are like, oh, that horse is crazy, that horse is wild, or that horse is just mean. And really there's, people don't take the time to think, well, what has caused that horse to do that? So.
I was thinking of doing that. It's got some interesting parallels to flight instruction. I used to teach flying. Pianchi flies. Warren, I've never asked him whether he does or not. I'd be curious. But as an instructor, you know, we didn't put people immediately into an airplane unless it was like a demo ride or something like that. But they're serious about learning. We talked to them for a while, and I always did this. I do for most of my intros. I'd spend at least an hour with them on the ground, just talking about the airplane, what the controls did, you know, where the instruments are and things like that. And then we'd go fly maybe the next week, give them a chance to read up and study. And that was always much more effective than just throwing people in. Is there like an equivalent, like a horse ground school, or do you have people get to know the individual horse they're going to ride them? And spend you know, half an hour with it before you even hop on, just getting to know that horse and learning about the horse's history and personality and things like that. Is there any kind of equivalent like that to what we do in aviation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I am not somebody that just throws people on. I do give them that opportunity to meet them, and I talk about them, and I go over each horse's quirks and their personalities. And a lot of times through the trail, I discuss, you know, their story behind it, you know, similar to Ed Miracle, the thoroughbred that won the $260,000, and how he came to me in our first trail ride. He, what I would call jigging, which is almost like a pace where he was trotting. He basically wasn't walking with his head down. He was very high-headed, very jiggy, very nervous, anxiety-ridden, you know, and that was after 6 months of rehabbing him because he was 200 pounds underweight and he couldn't even walk. His feet had been messed up. So I had to go through the corrective shoeings and the proper nutrition. And then I had to go back to, you know, the training aspect behind it of, hey, like, you know, I'm not on your back to run you or to race you or to push you through these jumps. I'm here specifically just to have a relaxing ride. And so teaching those horses that come from a performance-based home that they routinely are like trained like athletes, you know, to now is the time for you to relax. And it's time for you to just keep that head down and your calmness within and just walk the trail versus, you know, some of these horses are trained to not walk and to, you know, their purpose is I got to run as fast as I can around these barrels, or I got to make this winning lap, or, you know, things of that nature. And then asking them to come out and walk a simple trail ride with people that don't have much experience, that can't communicate with them as I would be able to communicate them to them, you know. And so a lot of horses associate when riders get on that it's work. You know, I have a ex-barrel horse that, I mean, in her younger days, I mean, when she was 6 months old, she was sold for $5,000, and that was her purpose, was to be a barrel horse. I mean, she had maturity bloodlines. She should have made it in the world, but at the end of the day, her heart wasn't in it, and her body just had been abused, and that's what people were buying her for, was, hey, she's got maturity bloodlines, and this is what she was bred for, so I'm going to race her. But she wasn't happy there, you know, and she's actually one of my horses that I put kids on, or that I put older people on that haven't rode, and she's so nice and so quiet. But at the end of the day, if you would have seen her 4 years ago when I first got her, when you couldn't even walk up to her on the trailer because she'd rear because she was so frightened about you and she couldn't control her emotions, or when you would get on her, you couldn't control her. She'd bolt out from underneath you or she'd jump side to side. And so having horses that are broken that just use more of their reactive side of their brain versus their thinking side of the brain and allowing them to come back to that thinking side of the brain, you know, that takes a lot of time, and a lot of dedication, and sometimes a lot of like questions of, you know, what has happened to you in your life and how am I going to be here to help you to get back to where you can be a nice, calm, relaxed horse.
Fascinating. Let's share the journey. Let's how you created from the first time you got an idea for your own place for horses in you to believing in the journey to making the journey happen. Let's hear that story.
Well, you know, like I said, as a little girl, it was all about horses. And when I was going through school, you know, my initial thing was I wanted to be an equine vet. I wanted to help horses in that nature. So after college, I graduated college before I graduated high school. So I did dual enrollment and I got my general AA. And as soon as I graduated, I started working at Safe Harbor in Pensacola, and Nat and Gina were the doctors.
Yep.
I'm 28 now. I was in college. I started my college degree in the 11th grade. So 11th and 12th grade, I was actually enrolled at PSC or Pensacola State College.
By the time
I was 18, I started my job at Safe Harbor, which wasn't a large animal vet clinic, but it was something to start with.
Right.
But throughout that process, I had horses, and I was always working at somebody's barn, or I was always doing, you know, I started training horses besides my own. So Pistol was my first. I got my second horse, who is my heart horse, Nakota, when I was 15. And I had to train her from the ground up. Actually, she was one of the first rescue horses. She was actually attacked by dogs and ran through some barbed wire fencing at the age of 7 months old. And instead of the people that had her previous fixing her, they wanted to shoot her. So I got her from a man that rescued her out of that situation. And then I started training her, and then the people across the street from me had some horses that were neglected and starved, and when animal control got involved, I took in one of the younger ones. He was my first horse that I ever sold and trained, and the people still own him to this day. His name is Merlin. And then, like I said, I worked through barns, and then I co-partnered with a friend and did trail ridings on the side for a couple of years, and all in the aspect of, you know, this is just going to be my side stuff. And then I'm just going to continue my journey of being an equine vet. Well, shortly after being in the vet world, that's a very hard world to be in. It's very stressful.
Why
similar
is that?
To human. It's just emotionally stressful. You know, again, these people aren't in it for the money. We're here to help the animals. But emotionally, what you have to go through and the hours that you have to put in, it's just, it's hard on people. You know, the amount of animals that come in and they're sick and you can't fix them and they have to be euthanized, or the amount of animals that you watch from the time that they were puppies and kittens to now they're 14 and 15 years old and you've had that connection with them, even if it was once or twice a year. But throughout it, you build those relationships with not only the animals, but with the people, and then having to deal with the emotional crisis when they are sick, and the responsibility of you're there to fix them, and the responsibility of telling them, you know, we can't fix them when it's too far gone. Emotionally, that's hard. you know, it's hard to come home and sleep at night, you know, knowing some of those animals that you just knew at the end of the day that they were going to make it, and unfortunately they didn't, you know, or just the fact that having to make that decision and live with it was probably one of the hardest things for me. And then once I realized that I wasn't going to be an equine vet, I wanted to be a hospital manager because that was the next best thing. And I love the fact, like, I loved helping my team grow, and I loved, you know, being that go-to person when people needed help, not only people, but when the animals needed help. So I got the chance to be the youngest hospital manager in a corporate position that ran 136 hospitals. I started that when I was 23, and I ended it when I was 26 is when I stopped being a hospital manager. I was the top third hospital out of 136 hospitals in this region, and I was the youngest hospital manager to be doing it. It was a hard choice for me to up and leave that. You know, I felt like I was needed there, and I felt like I could be the answer to everything for that facility during that transitional time of going from being a mom and pop vet clinic that had traditions for 30 years to now we're a corporate facility and we're changing all of these factors and making it more of a corporate type facility. So there was a lot of breaking points for the team and for our clients, you know, our established clients of 20 and 30 years that didn't understand the behind the scenes of it and what we were having to go through as well. It got to a point where, again, at the end of the day, what helped me with all those emotions was my horses and doing the horse stuff on the side. And it just was, I told myself I wanted to remain true to my heart and what was in my heart. And I don't really know the reason behind when I went to Loretta Lynn's and what really caused me to say, you know what, when I come home, I'm not going to go back to that. It was a hard, hard decision. I cried on it, and I called each one of my employees when I got back into town and apologized for not, you know, being there for them afterwards. And each one of them told me, you know, we support you and we're happy that you're making this move. And through that, a lot of them took the courage and they walked out the door. They took the courage to do what they wanted to do in their life. So it ended up being a blessing in disguise. But the reason I named it Believe the Journey is because it was just that. I needed to believe in my journey.
Makes sense. Makes perfect sense. So Loretta Lynn's was the hospital you were working at before?
Loretta Lynn's was the ranch that I went to on vacation. It was the first vacation I took hospital manager, and I was there for 7 days. And that's kind of just where I was sitting. I was actually on my cot sitting underneath the trees by the creek, and my horses were tied to the tree. And that's when I just shook my head and I said, I'm going to come home and I'm going to do this. And so I called my husband and I said, when I get back to Florida, I'm not going back to Safe Harbor. And he was like, okay. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to ride my horses and I'm going to allow people to come out and ride them. And so that's what I did.
Well, it's a good thing he's supportive. I mean, that makes a huge difference. Well, maybe I shouldn't assume.
Yeah.
I'm assuming he's supportive. Okay, good. Does he ride too? I mean, do you?
No, like, no, he doesn't ride. He supports me, but he's not a rider. And that's typical in the horse world. You normally don't have both of them riding.
Really? I would have thought there's maybe a shared path. Well, my ex was not into airplanes and I was, but that happens a lot. So as long as you're free to pursue your passions, then hopefully he has one that keeps him excited too, because that'd be good for both of you. You don't have to share the same passion as long as you share that you have passions. I think that's pretty critical. Okay, well, tell me what you got out there. So for my first time out there, what am I going to find? Where would we go? What kind of trails do you have? So give me the intro before I get there, because you know I want to do that.
Okay, so I right now have quite a few locations that I'm working through on finding new trails. My main one is there at Coldwater Recreational Area. So it's a big campground there at Coldwater. And they allow me to use it commercially to allow people to come on trail with me. So for intro people or their first time out with me, I will have us go there. Those trails are they're actually horse marked trails, and they're maintained by the forestry department there. And it's just got a beautiful setup. Like, I call it my home away from home. There's bathrooms there. There's the creek there. There's paddocks for the horses. So I actually drive to that location, and I offer either a 1 hour or 2 hour trail ride. Normally my group that I can take out physically without having to have a second hand hauling horses, I can take out a group of 4 to 5 riders. My 1 hour ride is when I allow children between the ages of 6 through 12 on it. I allow up to 2 at that age. And I actually hand walk beside them if they've never been experienced on trails or have got to experience trail rides. And then I also have a 2 hour trail ride, and that is for riders 13 and older. And again, I can do 4 to 5 riders depending on experience. And then there is times that I have my regular clients, or I have my friends that have their truck and trailers and their horses. And so it might be a group of 2 of us, or it could be a group of 10 of us. It just really depends on that day. And I don't normally do more than 4 hours a day of riding. And then once you come out at least one time with me and we make sure everything's vibing correctly and you want to explore more, I also offer a 4 hour trail ride. I also offer camping trips. I have camping trips out there at that location, as well as if you want to get more in depth with the world and do more of an outdoorsy experience, I offer some packing trips as well for adults or riders 16 and older. Once we get to that degree, those trails are more for advanced riders. We have a little bit more terrain, so we have to go and maneuver around more trees, or we have more underbrush we have to go through, or hills that we have to go up and down. But it's beautiful either way. And then when you come out, you meet me, we go over my liability form. I go over how I normally ride my horses, and I talk about relaxation and the communication aspect behind working with the horse. I don't ever say controlling the horse, or because it's not, you know, meditation between you and that horse. And then I go over their stories on who you're going to be on. And then I'll help you mount up, and then I'll make sure your stirrups are all set, and I'll make sure your hands are in the right place. And then it's pretty leader. I normally have 2 trail guides with me. I'm normally in the front or in the back, and vice versa.
Wow. This is fascinating. For those who don't know, we should get a little Coldwater. I'm not sure where that is, because we're actually worldwide. I didn't want to scare you at first, but we've been heard in over 50 countries. So just so folks know where we are. So I remember Milton, Florida is near Pensacola, and so Coldwater is north. You're up near the Alabama line?
Yes.
Okay, all right, that sounds good.
Yep,
so you don't have a fixed
location. By the Alabama line.
Okay, so you don't have a fixed location. You actually take your horses from your place to where the trail is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how it works?
Yep.
So people couldn't
visit.
You know. Oh, okay. And people can ride their horses or your horses. And okay, mm-hmm. This is fascinating. All right, well, let me open up again. We've got a few more minutes. Pianchi or Warren, if you have another question for Candace, now would be a good time. And then we'll get our contact information. And I want to get you back in springtime. I imagine people are going to ride more when the weather warms up a little bit. So we'll get you back. We'll talk about it. We'll give an intro. And then you can tell us. Actually, it'd be interesting to have you periodically check in just so we know what's going on in Horse World. You know, racing horses, you know, baby horses, anything, any topic in particular, how to feed and care for your horse, anything you want to do. We're going to talk more. This is going to be fun. I don't expect this to be last. Let's go, Warren. Warren, do you have a last question for Candace?
Well, I just thought that the whole conversation was very interesting and inspiring. And so I just like to encourage you to keep up the humanitarian work.
Thank you.
See, that's something I never anticipated. This is why I love having people on, and we don't talk about this ahead of time. But I had no idea the depth of this. I had no idea the emotional complexity of the horses. There's just a lot of things, but the relationship that you have with a horse. So I want to explore that further. That's quite fascinating. So, Warren, thanks for joining us today. Pianchi, anything you can think of?
Well, horses are beautiful animals, as is many. And it's always good to know that, you know, I've seen some people that's involved in rodeos. And I wonder how that hobby, and I guess it is a business to a certain extent, I wonder if that's continuing to go on. But no, keep up the good work, and I wish you much success.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I have a question. I have another question. I have a question.
I
want to
ask
one
about
more.
Rodeos now that the Yankees brought it up. But go ahead, Warren. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, what do you do about, to the young lady, what do you do about wild horses? What parts of the United States are wild horses located? And what is the government's position and use of wild horses, horses that are not broken and roaming?
That's a great question.
So that's a great question. So I actually have a couple of I've rescued a couple of Mustangs, and I have one Mustang that I actually did my first clinic with. I've taught him how to lay down. He bows, he smiles, he kisses. And we're working on training him now how to ride. But Bureau of Land Management, BLM, is basically the government side of the wild Mustangs. Primarily they're out west, but I've seen them come through the auction yards from California, from Iowa, Idaho, Nevada, Wyoming, Oregon, New Mexico. And there's not really they do have to do the roundups because there's just no way of controlling that population. Unfortunately, a lot of Mustangs end up in your government holding pens, and then they are kind of shipped across America to these auction events that they have. And there's some programs like the Mustang Makeovers, which is really phenomenal that they have that out there, where they basically assign you a Mustang and you have 100 days, train it, and then you compete with it afterwards at a big show, and then you can auction it off from there, or you can choose to keep that Mustang. There's not a whole bunch here in Milton, Florida that are involved, but we've had the last couple years, we've had BLM actually come and bring a shipment of horses for us to adopt out here. And there's a couple other programs, such as you adopt one and you get $1,000 incentive if you keep that Mustang for a year. They are titled, so they're not allowed to go into places where they ship to, like Mexico and Canada, which is unfortunate. But again, at the end of the day, there's really no way of controlling the population that we have for domesticated horses and wild horses. But, you know, I am fortunate that there is programs out there like the BLM that have the land, that provide the land, and that also have those holding pens. And for the, you know, the people that are trying to support that dream and try to keep that Mustang heritage alive, me as well, you know, that we try to do our best in helping with that population and helping them, the Mustangs, get a good home or stay in the wild. But that's pretty much the gist of the Mustang heritage. And it's mainly out west. There is a couple feral populations also, like in Virginia, and there's islands on the East Coast that have the ponies. And I actually got an opportunity when I was in Missouri to actually get a chance to see some of the wild Mustangs that the locals there, where they help feed and make sure that they're doing okay, and they round them up once a year for their vaccines and just to check them over. But it's, you know, you don't hear about the Mustangs in the Ozarks. It was such a pleasure seeing them on the side of the road, but if I wasn't following them on Facebook, I would have never even thought that Missouri had wild Mustangs. And it's not a huge herd. It's just a herd of 12. But still, the local counties there are involved to kind of help keep that culture there and to keep those horses there.
Hmm. This is interesting. A Mustang, is that a particular – is it an actual breed, or is it just a horse or a horse population that is wild, that is living free up there?
It's more of a horse population that's wild. I mean, a lot of the Mustangs were back in the day, it was originated by the Spanish breeds that came over. Throughout the years, you got to think of all the horses that may have gotten loose, or the domesticated horses that people have let go to run with them. So you can get one that looks more like an Arabian from the auctions. They have draft cross Mustangs, but at the end of the day, they're branded and they're classified as Mustang. Which just initiates, hey, they either came from a holding pen, born and bred, or they were captured from the wild and brought into population.
Rodeos, what's your feeling on rodeos?
I love rodeos. Again, I wasn't grown up with it. I did do some barrel racing back in my day. I even went all the way to
What's
Martha
that?
Josie Clinic. So barrel racing
barrel
is where
racing?
For you don't